The Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is a podcast dedicated to practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, called practical politics because it is all non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is always rule-based politics. Every 2 years, every 4 years, it's basically what you do at the voting booth. And then there is full-spectrum practical politics, or engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the rules but never breaking the rules. But to do anything, we have to start with practical politics, and in this case, it's the art of staying on message. It's having a consistent message. And our consistent message is a mantra, or white rabbit genocide you see on this front page. And we will also, in this podcast, engage in the geopolitical. We will talk about geopolitical events. We will talk about things from a unique white rabbit perspective. We will also go into white rabbit psychology and ecology and talk about everything you'd want to know about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And this is, again, the Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. Out of all the questions I get asked day in, day out, there's always a ton of questions about China. Everyone's scared to death of the Chinese. The Chinese are going to get us. The Chinese are going to invade Los Angeles. They're going to take this. They're going to do that. And this is something kind of endemic to the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. They tend to do this type of thing all the time. They look at another group and assume that they're going to be just like us, or do just what we did with some with their money or with their weapons. Or even if they convert to Christianity or something like that. This has become something our race always goes through. We're not racial, and that is racial. So even when you come into white nationalists or those that think they know something, those that think they're quote-unquote racially aware, you still have this big challenge. Because they will consistently, and this goes for all of us, they will consistently look at an event and assume that they're going to do exactly what we did with it, or something along those lines. And before I get to China, let's go over a few historical events, and I'll just do a handful because you can sit here all day with them. When the indigenous white rabbits of Europe came to America, they looked at the indigenous red rabbits of North America, the Indians. And they assumed that they would just be Christians. If they just converted them to Christianity, they would be just like white Europeans, but red. They thought they'd be just like us. And of course, it never worked out. There's one in every group that'll say otherwise, but not much more than that. But it never worked out. Then if you go forward in America, you have the indigenous black rabbits of Africa who are in America because of slavery and whatever. And immigration, really. They were in America, and they wanted equal rights and to end segregation in the South. And the thinking was that if we end segregation, the Africans in America would just be just like the white rabbits. All the liberals thought that. Yeah, they'd just be just like us once we desegregated them. we tend to do this time and time again. And then we come into the 80s, and let's take it from another angle. The Japanese rabbits doing very well for themselves financially in the 80s. They were taking over everything. They were going to take over the world. They were going to get even with the white rabbits for World War II or something along those lines. And all these conspiracy theories about the Japanese were going to get us with all their money. And they did have a lot of money, and they were buying up everything. But it never materialized the way white rabbits thought. Why? Because the Japanese aren't white. Yeah. That little thing about race being real. Race is so real, white rabbits will continuously look at another rabbit and assume they're going to do exactly what we did with it. But they never will. They never, ever will. And so when Japan didn't conquer the world financially like the Anglo elites or like the Russians are doing now with their money, or like white rabbits tend to do from time to time, they just go on to something else. And then they turn around and start worrying about another rabbit, thinking they're going to do exactly what we did with something in the same position. And it's never once materialized, ever. No, they've never once got it right. And so when it comes to China is, of course, trying to build a deep water navy. Or blue water navy. I'll use the correct term in the English language. Blue water navy. They're trying to build one, and they're trying to build a global navigation system, a GPS system. And so, of course, the assumption is that they're going to do this. They're going to do this to attack us. They're going to do this to get us. They're going to do it for this reason or that reason. And here we go again. Here we go again. The Chinese have a Marine Force horse, and they're going to get us with that Marine Force. They're going to invade Los Angeles. Here we go again. There we go again. Assuming another race is going to do what we do with something is flawed. You can't point to one instance where it's ever worked. It doesn't ever work. And it's not your fault for doing that. We all do that. We assume that race is real, and then we turn around and we immediately assume another race is going to do what we do with the same position of advantage or disadvantage or make moves like us. It never once works out. Ever. Period. Ever. And so let's go over a Blue Water Navy and what it is. Blue Water Navy is basically an aircraft carrier. It's significant. It's one of the most significant things on the planet. You don't hear about it because if you look it up under Wiki, I'm going to guess there's only four white countries with a Blue Water Navy, a true Blue Water Navy. Russia, France, there's another one, United Kingdom. In America has 11 carrier groups. We got the largest blue water navy in the history of blue water navies. Seriously. We got a navy larger than the next 12 navies on this planet combined. Now, there are other white rabbit nations that can build blue water navies. The other ones would probably be Germany. Russia could build a bigger one. So on and so forth. But non-whites basically don't build them. Oh, India has an aircraft carrier, I think, from Britain, but that doesn't really count. Most other races don't build them. The only exception to the rule would be the Japanese. And the Japanese have one of our carrier groups. America has 11 carrier groups. One is stationed in Japan full-time. So Japan doesn't have to build a navy. They got ours there. And that's been a contentious issue over the years for the Japanese, but basically we know why it's there now. It's there for World War III. it's there because the Japanese emperor or whoever's running the show there and his cohorts want it there. That's part of his deal. And in all fairness to the Japanese, they have a very advanced sub fleet, and submarines seem to be something that these non-white groups tend to buy, and they tend to drive around a lot. They like that. There's not a whole lot to hit down there. And they can play that hunt for Red October, but I don't think very many groups really actually do those deep blue water maneuvers like we see in the hunt for Red October. But Japan has a sophisticated submarine fleet. It's about 40 submarines. It could easily take out China's submarine fleet, in my opinion. China's submarine fleet is nowhere near advanced or modern. It's just in the point of being modernized. The Chinese have said they had a three-point plan. One is they want to have this near plan where they take over Southeast and Northeast Asia and basically have an influence as high from Japan down to the Philippines. It's like this whole ring around China that they want to control. And of course that creates a problem. And problems always get reactions, and reactions always get solutions. And this little red dragon has right now created a problem for himself. I'll get to that in a second. But their first, that was their first, their first goal, their first naval goal. Their second goal is to expand that a little bit and to start going around the world a little bit more. And their third goal by 2000, and that's supposed to be by 2020. The third goal is to be able to have a true blue water navy. They can go anywhere and to be big enough to support all their shipping and stuff like that. And that's by 2050. They could probably have it a little bit sooner, maybe, but they've never built an aircraft carrier. They're just now trying to build one, and they bought a Russian ship, and they're figuring it out. They got a few different designs going, and they're trying to field one of them by 2020. And so there's all this hubbub. They have Marines. They have about, I don't know, they say they have about 10,000 Marines. They probably have close to five times that. But the size of an army doesn't matter anymore. Yeah, the size of an army is totally obsolete. China's navy at one time supposedly had like 4 or 5 million rabbits. Now they've cut that number way down because size doesn't matter. Big armies make big targets. We assume that the Asians can do a blue water navy and do exactly what we're going to do with it and carry on a war exactly like we can carry one on. And the only ones silly enough on this planet to actually believe that are white rabbits. I mean, no one's ever done that in the history of the world. The only ones that could even come close would be the Japanese, and they got nuked. I mean, think about that. So it's not really a good example, sending aircraft carriers to come around attacking things. To go around attacking things, because you can get nuked too. But anyways, when it comes to what they're going to do or what their intentions are, I say their intentions are what they say they're going to do. Their intentions are to dominate South and Northeast Asia and their near strategy and then be able to support their ships, their supply lines. Right now their ships are on, they use, I believe, America's global positioning system. You never really heard a lot about global positioning systems. White rabbits take it for granted. The reason you don't hear about it is because there's only three countries in the world that operate them, and those countries are all white. So China's trying to build one. The three countries would be, Europe has a system called Galileo that is, it's online. As soon as you put up one satellite, that satellite's online, but it'll be fully hooked up all over the world sometime next year. The Russians have, of course, GLONASS or whatever it's called. It is a global positioning system. Russia has one. And that is operational. And the U.S. has the biggest and the best one, on the planet. We have at least four times as many satellites up, and that's just what we know about. But the Chinese are trying to build Compass. They're trying to enter White Rabbit territory. Compass, of course, is their global positioning system, and that will be in 2020. And of course, the emails come in, Horace, if they get that global positioning system, they could do this and that. And my email back will be, if my aunt had balls, she'd be my uncle. If as a stretch of nature, you're assuming they would do with it what we want to do with it, what they want to do with it, what they say, and what they're trying to do. And I don't have any reason to believe otherwise. They need a global positioning system because they don't want to rely on anyone else to send their big freighters around the world. You know, they send goods all over the stinking planet. And they need a blue water navy to look out for that stuff. Well, there's a point to be made there because I'm not going to be looking out for it. So we'll go over some news events because this little red dragon in doing this has got not so much the attention of the European elites. They don't I don't think they're too afraid of China, but it's got some attention. It's got some attention from some military planners because they haven't let their supposedly they've been pretty secretive. It's certainly got some attention from their neighbors, whether it be the Vietnamese, the Indonesians, the Philippines. The Taiwanese, the Japanese, the Koreans. It's got a whole lot of tensions from there. They're in this defense group called the Karat, C-A-R-A-T. And, of course, what you have now are the largest naval maneuvers, whether it be with the Karat or another. There's actually another defense organization that includes, like, Brunei and all these other countries. But there's been military maneuvers, some of the largest naval maneuvers in the history of the world as we know it. And in Asia, surrounding this little red dragon. And this little red dragon has basically created a problem for himself. His strategy is to claim everything that he feels was rightfully his at one time. Most of my listeners don't know it, but Vietnam was once Chinese. Vietnam broke off from China at 900 AD. And the Chinese came in there with this little Marine Corps, and they do what Marine Corps do. They knock They knocked the Vietnamese off their little islands, some of their little islands on Paracel Islands. You can look up the Paracel Islands chain, that's P-A-R-A-C-E-L. And they knocked them off there, I think it was in 73, 74. That was their little naval marine victory. And they've been creating a series of problems for themselves after they claim the Indonesian islands. They're knocking over Filipino fishing boats. And they've ticked off all those little rabbits. Now, you might not think the Vietnamese are much. Half a million in their armed forces, and in reality, they could probably put 10 million in flip-flops and AK-47s right now. You might not think much of that. In America, they killed about 50-some thousand American servicemen and definitely wounded well over 300,000. I know I had an uncle that was wounded in the Vietnam War, and he wouldn't be counted as a casualty, but it certainly did cost him his life because he didn't live for more than 10 years afterwards. But they never count it like they should. But and of course America killed a few million of them, and they're still there. And they are itching to fight the Chinese way more than they were ever itching to fight the Americans. They're pretty calm and easy, and just leave them alone. But you start knocking rabbits off their land, especially in East Asia, and claiming territory, and oh, you will tick them off. And so all these little countries are barking at the Americans. And I don't know whether they're barking at the Green Goddess or the Red Hippo, because this is a tough one to figure out. But they've been barking to do something about this. You know, they're willing to do something. I mean, you know, Vietnam has a benefactor. The benefactor most think would be the Americans. The Americans have give quite a bit of foreign aid there, and they're in the WTO, and the Vietnam is doing well for himself. But the largest foreign aid into Vietnam is, of course, the Japanese. And the Japanese, of course, occupied the place, I think, in the 40s. But they like the Japanese. The Japanese like them. And Vietnam just signed a big weapons deal with Russia. They're buying themselves kilo-class submarines and all kinds of stuff like that. And they're starting to build up their army and navy because you got this big... they border China, and China views Vietnam as theirs, basically, one time. And they do this with Philippines and Indonesia and all through there. The Chinese can be a dominant business class. And this becomes a pretty dicey situation because on their own, Vietnamese can't really do anything about that. But if you got the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force overhead, it don't take a whole lot. You just have to be willing to die, and they can pretty much make a run of things. And so it becomes a dice roll. They got all these military maneuvers with Vietnam and Indonesian special forces, and they're all ticked off at this little red dragon. So, by letting China run around there and run its strategy and push people around and knock over Filipino fishing boats and all this stuff they do and claiming all this land, someone allowed them to create a problem. That problem got a huge natural reaction. And that reaction always gets a solution. And so now you've got U.S. naval assets pretty much circling them. You've got huge naval maneuvers going against them in North Korea. You got the Japanese in on it. You got the Taiwanese. You got all these groups that would love to spank this little red dragon and bring them down to size. And you got Uncle Sam's Navy and Uncle Sam's Air Force that can just step back and pound the living daylights out of you. Yeah, they can do that. So I've been asked a series of questions it's a tough one to read because inside China, let me give you one basic little fact. The Yakuza is a Japanese gangster group, and this Japanese gangster group is quite famous in movies, and they're like the military veterans at the UFCW, except they got guns and samurai swords. The Japanese Yakuza are a pretty big deal in Japan, in the underground circles of crime. They're like the Japanese mafia. But they were formed in 50 BC in China. You got elements in the triads like that. I'm just giving you one example. There are two sides of China, and it is very tough to read. It's as tough to read as some things in Anglosphere for us. There's two sides. And I don't know exactly if this little red dragon is going to get taken out and cannibalized because he has a big public central bank. Not allowed to have that. I don't know if he didn't make a move too soon against his, these pink rabbit banksters and elitesters are like gangsters. It's like the Chicago mob trying to take out the New York mob. Well, you better be ready to go. If you start doing that, and the New York mob is a lot stronger, you're going to get pounded. You're going to get pounded. And the Red Hippo will sit back and let them pound each other because of survival of the fittest. So it's very, very tough to read. But one thing I do know for sure is that large naval war games can precede large naval wars. And there's enough ships at any given time in the East China Sea and all these, the Pacific Ocean, you can just walk across it from Taiwan to Japan to Vietnam. And these rabbits want to go at it with the Chinese. Now, granted, they don't individually want to go at it with the Chinese. But you start talking about China having to go up against the U.S. Navy, U.S. Air Force, that's bad enough. Having to go up against Korea, well, Korea would be invalidated against North Korea, but having to go up against the Taiwanese, the Japanese, the Vietnamese, the Indonesians, the Philippines, you can just imagine. They would just gang up on them. Oh, and not only that, but they've ticked off a lot of their landlocked neighbors, like Mongols. Yeah, the Mongols don't like the Chinese either. They're all cheesed off at them. Well, you can't fight the world. They've ticked off everyone in the area because I've never seen so many rabbits jumping up and down to have all these U.S. aircraft carriers cruising through the Pacific, all these boomers, all these submarines we got on maneuver around there. They're all welcoming it. The Vietnamese are welcoming it. And, of course, China is just hissing. The little red dragon is hissing. So I don't know exactly what's going on other than the trend. The trend is toward big war games, and big war games can mean big wars. And, you know, I've said that Asia, I wouldn't surprise me if Asia goes up, I would think Asia would go up in flames during World War III. I just don't know how it'll come about. And it may be any day. I have no idea who's going to trigger it or what's going to trigger what. What's going to trigger the actual war, but China will not do with their Blue Water Navy what we think they will. They won't do what we do with it necessarily. And they certainly won't do what we think they're going to do with their global positioning system. They got a long ways to go to 2020. They got a long ways to go to 2050. They haven't even fielded an aircraft carrier. They're just looking to dominate their area, and someone's been smart enough to step back and let them do it. And they've built up a huge number of enemies against them. In my opinion, it may just be the pink rabbit banksters and the leasters are pressed for time. And when you're pressed for time, you don't have to 2020 to start moving your stuff from America to China. You know, they have a history of getting a country deep in debt, building up an enemy against them. And then the country deep in debt, they break in half, and then they consolidate power in that country and move to their next victim. And that's the scenario many of the white nationalists believe that they're trying to do with China, and they would be right. Except that it's 2010; they don't have that kind of time. We're late 2010; we're only a few months away from 2011. They don't have that type of time. So what they might be doing is going to break China in half, going to spank that little red dragon. There might be an inter ethnic conflict in the pink rabbit world. And the pink rabbit banksters and leasters in China may have to give it up, they may get broken in half, and they may consolidate into America, because America is the only country that you have to have a new world order, and you have to have agreement with Russia. So America is a lot more important right now in 2010. China doesn't have the military assets to go with yet, and they ain't going to have it. They ain't going to have it in the next year or so. They certainly don't have a world reserve currency like America. America has all the assets ready to go for a new world order. They just don't have the population. They have the top, and they have some deal with Russia, which should be interesting to see what comes of that. But as far as what China can do, what China can't do, there's not a whole lot. I was asked by Asian listeners, do I think they're going to go with the first strike option, the decapitation? I don't know. They can certainly do that. Yeah, it sounds crazy, doesn't it? You go for a catastrophic first strike with a bunch of low yield mini nukes, knock out the head of the little red dragon, and then he puts up his countermeasures, which will be a few nukes. A handful of nukes, and those get shot down. They have missile interceptors all over the planet now. The Netherlands has Aegis missile interceptors. The Spanish have them. They have them ringed around the Middle East and ringed around Asia. Japanese have them. Supposedly the Koreans, they all have these missile interceptors. So I don't know. China's whole strategy has been denial, buy time, and deny U.S. access to the Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia. The problem is that China can't fight multiple wars on multiple fronts against all their neighbors that are cheesed off at them. And they can't let the United States sit back and hit them. So I don't know. Supposedly what they can do real well is hacking. And that's something their numbers can work for them. They got a lot of little hackers. They got a lot of numbers. They can't, their big army will never serve them, because big armies just make big targets, but a lot of hackers may serve them. Maybe they can disable an aircraft carrier. Maybe they can, do some kind of hacking attacks. But this denial of area type strategy that they have is interesting. It would be interesting in the event that they just went at it with the United States, but they're not just going at it with the United States. I mean, you got all these groups cheesed off, and they're willing to go into military maneuvers in front of China's face. You know, Singapore is in bed with the Anglo elites, and they're real tight with the Pink Rabbit banksters and elitesters. And again, it's always a tough read. But Singapore called for a free trade deal with Taiwan. That's going to read like the grapes of wrath. That's not something you do with the Chinese in regards to Taiwan. And the Singapore is run by a group of Chinese elites. So this is a difficult one to read. I can only point to the obvious that they won't do what we think they're going to do. Now, as far as how crazy it sounds, like first strikes or decapitation options, well, that's what Israel wants us to do to Iran. That's what they're going for with Iran, because that works. It gets an opponent can do minimal things against a decapitation, against a big first strike that America can deliver. The only one that can do anything against it is the Russians. The Russians always, in every war game, the Russians always get you somehow. China doesn't really have what they'd like you to believe they have, like most of these sources would like you to buy into. And of course, the Chinese have just released a new missile. And this is a great example. I'll read to you a sane analysis of their new missile. You see, the Chinese don't have GPS. They don't have a lot of satellites, so they can't really see anything. So having a missile is one thing, but you actually got to hit something with it. And it's easier said than done. You know, I talked about Iran and these Sunburn missiles, but you got to actually get close enough to use it. That's something we take for granted. The Russians can do it. They'll figure out a way. I don't know if Iran can. I don't know if they can. They can certainly hit fixed positions. I mean, China certainly should be able to hit Taiwan or Japan. One would hope. But it wouldn't be the first time our race made up a little red dragon into something big that it was nothing but a little paper dragon. And so I can only say that they won't do what we think they're going to do. I'm guessing it would be something with hacking. But of course, it's all speculation until the first starts flying. But I'm going to read you a piece. It's an interesting piece about China's new carrier-killing missile is overrated. And there's some people on DefPro. I think it stands for Defense Pro. It's defpro.com, D-E-F-P-R-O.com. And I'm going to put this up because this is decent analysis of what they can or can't do. But again, we don't know anything until the first starts flying. And decapitations and nuking someone sounds a little crazy, but someone's going for broke here very soon. It's not if, it's when. Someone's going for broke, and they're getting the museums ready. I'm going to go into that in this question and answer and everything else. They're getting all this ready in front of 2012, and that's their big date. I know it now for a fact. For some reason, they got to have it together by then. And of course, this is part of all these war games going on in Asia, but we won't know anything until they start it. But if they don't want to fool around with the Chinese, if they don't want to fool around with Iran, they can go for decapitations. Crazy? Sure. But they can do it. It is an option. China does not have a first strike option in their constitution, and of course, in other words, they have an anti-first strike in their constitution. They will never take a first strike, but some say that's just because they can't. But let me read you this piece about China's new carrier-killing missile on DefPro.com. And the piece is by Lauren B. Thompson. He has a PhD. And it says, speculation, last week saw China's new carrier-killing missile is overrated. Last week saw another round of semi-hysterical speculation about China's new Dongfeng missile, which supposedly has the accuracy required to attack a U.S. aircraft carrier from 900 miles away. Professor Tashi Yashihara of the War College told the Associated Press that the new missile signals the U.S. Navy no longer rules the waves as it has since the end of World War II, and sea control cannot be taken for granted anymore. Patrick Cronin of the Center for a New American Security said the missile is potentially capable of stopping our naval projection. Investors Business Daily compared the Pentagon's lack of response to the Dongfeng with Navy complacency in the days leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor, and saw the emerging anti-ship threat as further evidence of the world is entering a Chinese century. I haven't seen the intelligence report, so maybe all the alarm is warranted, but I doubt it. China has yet to conduct a single realistic test of the conventional armed ballistic missile. Even if it performs as feared, there is a glaring omission in all the threat mongering. The People's Liberation Army has no reliable way of actually targeting U.S. carrier task force when they're at sea. No matter how accurate the new missile's guidance systems may be, Chinese military commanders need to know where to aim it, especially since a near miss with a conventional warhead has pretty much the same military value as missing by 100 miles. So how exactly is the PLA supposed to find the U.S. carriers when they are constantly moving and actively excluding hostile forces from their immediate vicinity? The answer is that it can't. 4.5 acres of sovereign U.S. territory, the way carrier proponents often describe flat tops, may sound like a huge target, but in fact it is a mere speck in the vast expanses of the Western Pacific. For example, the modestly sized South China Sea that Beijing keeps trying to claim for itself contains over 1 million square miles of water, in which a carrier can easily hide, and that's only a small part of the East Asia littoral. Littoral means ocean claims. Our ocean water surrounding. I calculated a decade ago that to acquire continuous target quality information for the entire South China Sea, the PLA would need over 100 low Earth orbit reconnaissance satellites moving in 3 parallel tracks. At the moment, China only has a handful of such satellites. And as a result, most of the time, its overhead sensors aren't anywhere near areas of interest. It also has over-the-horizon radars and roaming submarines, plus a fleet of reconnaissance aircraft, but these do not add up to the seamless targeting network the PLA would need to track and attack a U.S. carrier. The Navy is currently investing in upgrades to its Aegis combat system and other defense equipment aimed at dealing with maneuvering warheads such as the Dongfeng would carry. These defensive measures would likely come to fruition long before Beijing has a reliable way of targeting our carriers. In addition, the Navy has numerous kinetic and non-kinetic strike options that could be used to rapidly degrade whatever surveillance network the PLA has assembled if the threat of an attack against U.S. carriers were deemed serious enough. And then there are all the passive signature management measures the Navy might undertake to foil the tracking efforts of the PLA using remote sensors. Frankly, the U.S. Navy has so many options for negating anti-ship capabilities that I can only conclude the alarmists aren't conversant with U.S. military preparations to be so worried about the nascent Dongfeng. Of course, losing even one aircraft carrier would be a huge blow to the American psyche, but the American response would be so devastating that Beijing would soon regret its boldness. The value of $1 trillion in Chinese currency reserves would evaporate overnight. China's access to the world's richest export market would end. Its information networks would largely cease functioning. Its sea-based supply lines to Persian oil and Australian minerals would be severed. And all that could happen even before the U.S. bombs begin falling on Chinese territory. So while we can't be absolutely certain that China's leaders won't someday be foolish enough to attack a U.S. aircraft carrier, we can be pretty damn sure they would soon realize they had made a big mistake. Now, I don't necessarily agree with all the article has to say, but you quickly get an even-handed view of what their capabilities are. Their capabilities, again, it's not 2020, 2050, it's 2010, and someone's going for a new world order, and this little red dragon is going to get in line or be spanked. And the problem is, when you allow someone like the little red dragon to run around and tick off all its neighbors, well, you don't have to do a whole lot except rally them. They're all ticked off. And 500,000 Vietnamese soldiers may not sound like a lot on the border, but I know my country's experience in fighting them, and I know how bad these guys want to go at it with the Chinese. That's all they bitch about day and night, Chinese taking their islands. It's one thing for the Chinese to fight the Vietnamese. It's a whole other thing to have to fight them and the Japanese and everything else with the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force bearing down on you. And the elements of the U.S. Navy and Air Force they would be fighting would be the whitest elements of the U.S. forces, actually. The U.S. aircraft carriers can be multiracial. They're like floating cities, floating cesspools. Yeah, when it comes to the U.S. Navy, and the U.S. Air Force, especially when you come into missile defense and stuff like that, apparently, it's incredibly white. I'm reminded of a piece from Time Magazine. I'm actually found this online, and I'm going to put this up on my Twitter. And the piece is from 1972, and I think putting out stuff like this is actually better than me giving a spiel on the different racial things going on in the U.S. Armed Forces, but this was done on Monday, November 27, 1972. It's actually online. It says, Armed Services, keyhauling the United States Navy. 2 years ago, Chief of Naval Operations Elmo Zumwalt set about changing what he called the lily white racist Navy into an even-handed institution that would be able to track recruits and keep and promote black within its ranks. All of his innovative ideals attempt to fully integrate the Navy seemed to me to be the most courageous and substantial. And you could read the piece for yourself. It's from 1972, and I mean, my goodness, some of us weren't even born then. But it's a funny piece. And then come forward, and we noticed this summer, just on July 30th, 2010, white Navy officers are more likely to be promoted than blacks or Hispanics. You see, and they did this whole big study this summer. They released a study from the Navy. What they're trying to do is develop a secret list of minorities who choose to live, or majorities who choose to live with white rabbits as minorities, is what they are. Yeah, there are no minorities with white rabbits. There are majorities who choose to live with us as minorities. You know, the black Africans don't want to live with their people, so they want to live with us. But anyways, sorry for that little tangent on racial tangent, but we got to get things straight. These so-called minorities, these majorities, as I call them, are complaining because they're not getting promoted in the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy, of course, my first impression was kind of shocked at this, that they were going to have to develop a secret list of these black and brown and speckly brown and yellow rabbits that have to be promoted in the Navy. And this list is secret, and they must be promoted into officer positions. So that got me thinking, here we are in 2010, and you've got to take draconian measures like that, when in 1972, I just read you the piece. So here you are, you know, what is it, 40 years later nearly, you know, you're 40 years late, nearly 40 years later, and you still don't have minority officers in some areas in the Navy. You don't, in fact, you don't have... I was shocked talking to a young sailor who sails on one of these ships. An aircraft carrier has so many different ships, but one of these these different missile destroyers and the different Aegis type ships. And he was telling me the ship he was on. There were several ships around him that he works with when he was in the Navy, and he just got out recently. Yeah, didn't reenlist, and he said that there was not a black or a speckly brown rabbit or a yellow rabbit to be found on these ships. He said they're all on the carriers, you know, doing cooking and some different positions on carriers. You know, carriers like a floating multicultural, multiracial city these days. But he says when it comes to the pilots, when it comes to several different defense, especially when you get into missile defense, they're still all white. It's so technical. I was thinking it was like the Army already, but I wasn't really thinking things through, that our Navy and our Air Force is so technical that some positions are always going to be white. And that's the problem they've had, which is a wonderful problem. If in 2010 they got to create special lists for minorities in the Navy, it's because it totally failed there. Multicultural, multiracialism. You know, in the Army, all you do is what the sailor pointed out to me is in the Army, all you got to do is give a Mexican a gun and teach them how to fight. Some of them can be pretty good soldiers. In the Navy, it can be a little more complicated, especially in the Navy or the Air Force. There's some very technical stuff there, and over the past, since the 70s, it gets more technical by the year, so I wasn't thinking of that. So I was asked how much would multiracialism, multiculturalism play a role in the U.S. military? It plays a huge role. It plays a huge role in some elements of the Navy. It plays a huge role, I'm sure, in, you know, maybe in the mechanics barracks or somewhere like that in the Air Force. But push comes to shove when it comes to missile defense and our submarines and stuff like that. I mean, it's just, it's so not multiracial in some areas. They have to go to draconian measures in 2010. If you're having to go to draconian measures, like secret list of officers that have to be minority, these speckly rabbits that have to be promoted, in certain areas of the Navy, that tells you how much it's failed in certain areas or how much they've been able to hold it over. So I think that was a pleasant surprise. But I've talked to sailors like this. They said if you're not on an aircraft carrier, there's not necessarily it's not as black and brown as elements of the Army. And I thought that caught me a little off guard. I don't know what they're all doing on the aircraft carrier. I guess they're at various different positions, cooking and everything else. I know they're not a bunch of Navy pilots. We don't have a bunch of Mexican Navy pilots. Who knows what they'll have 20 years from now. But, of course, it's not 2030. It's 2010. So we got to look at what's going on right now. So I don't know exactly what's going to shape up in East Asia. I'm just giving you the trend. There's big naval war games. This little red dragon that was birthed by the red hippopotamus has maybe get himself cannibalized. I don't know exactly. These groups are so have so much going on into this into these events, and everything starts with a war. I've always told you that. But in the next little section, I'm going to go over some news events on Asia. Then I'm going to go over some updates on the Middle East. We know what the Israelis are waiting for now. At least I believe I do. And I'm going to go over that. And then I'm going to talk about an update on King Tut. Very serious update on King Tut. Our enemy there's two question marks in our history where our enemy got going. One is Babylon and one is Egypt. Egypt is the most recent, and I know the one where they came into the West. Yeah, we know how elements of our enemy came into the West. They came in through Rome. I will go into that in a future podcast, and I'll read to you from Banksters in Babylon. Banksters from Here to Babylon, Joseph P. Farrell's book, but we're going back to Egypt, and the spotlight in Egypt has always been on Akhenaten and Akhenaten's son, Tutankhamun. And we're going to go over that because there's a big event taking place in the Giza Plateau that's not been talked about. They haven't revealed it yet. And this has everything to do with our enemy's New World Order or elements of it. It's the direction of the truth, if there is any such thing. So I will fill you in and give you updates because there's been some updates with old King Tut. But some of this stuff is just pieces to a puzzle, and all these pieces are starting to come together all across the planet. And we're just sitting and watching these things unfold. I've been asked several times, do I think September is a very hot date for some different groups are passing around these as war dates all over the world. You're getting these dates as war dates. I don't set war dates. I think it's impossible. I do know that 2012, from now until 2012, by 2012, someone feels they have to have their New World Order together. But they don't have a New World Order. They don't have it. At the top of America, they got some Russian agreement. So we're going to have to sit and watch this one. And we're going to have to do our job, and our job is simply beyond a consistent message. So let's go through this with you. And this is I'm answering all the questions I got recently about the Middle East, all these questions about China. Hopefully this can kind of fill you in. A fear-based thinking, if you're afraid of, the black rabbits in Toledo. Let's just make up a date. Toledo, Ohio. You're generally going to be more attuned to negative news reports regarding the situation with the black rabbits in Toledo. Fear is like that. Fear limits your focus. But, you've got to try to break out of that and get to a more balanced news sources. I'm not saying those news sources aren't relevant, but you got to look at the whole picture. You know, you got to understand this. If you look down and you're still white, you're still all right. You know, if you look down and you're speckly brown, well, you got problems. Until that happens, keep your head up and stay on message. But we'll go through these news events. Now, looking at a map of China, if you go to Google Maps or any map service and pull up China, you're going to notice that there's an East China Sea and a South China Sea. And then there's a Philippine Sea. And then you got Japan, South Korea, North Korea, two kind of the around the East China Sea, and then you have Vietnam, Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia down in the South China Sea, and then out in the open behind Taiwan you have the Philippine Sea, and you can pull up a map and look at it. And what I'm going to do is go through some news pieces on what exactly is going on in this area. Earlier I used the term Blue Water Navy or Deep Water Navy. Different cultures and different navies and different nations, even in the West, use all different terms for this phrase, Blue Water Navy. Now, if you wiki, and now the English language Wikipedia, Blue Water Navy, you should be able to find out what I'm talking about. I don't know if they have Deep Water Navy in there. There are so many different naval lingo can change from country to country, but generally speaking, blue water, deep water navy can be interchangeable. If you don't know what I'm talking about by deep water navy, look up blue water navy. If you don't know what I'm talking about by blue water navy, ask about a deep water navy or a blue green water navy. In America now, they got green water navies, brown water navies. I stick to the basics. Blue water navy, deep water navy, for me, are interchangeable. But generally speaking, on Wiki, I just looked, it's blue water navy, just so you understand. It means they can go around the world, and they got big carriers. Most white countries, all the countries that have them right now are white. And there's several more white countries that can build them. It's that simple. Japan certainly could build one. But China, what China's doing, if you look at your map, what they're doing is they're working out in their first phase. Their first phase is to defend all this land they claim up to the Philippines, up to Japan. And by and large, depending on who you're talking to, they claim all that stuff too. And the Paracel Islands, it's a famous island chain, and it consists of the Spratly Islands, all these little islands there right near Vietnam. And it was, I believe the exact date they threw them off was in 73, 74. The Chinese threw the Vietnamese off some of their islands, and no one likes getting thrown off nice little islands. And then they had a big shindig with Vietnam, a war in 1980, and China kind of embarrassed Russia, I believe,
showed Vietnam that they couldn't trust, that the Russians weren't powerful enough to help them in Chinese backyard, and they won that conflict with Vietnam. Vietnam's kind of been leery of them ever since. They have disputes with Indonesia over islands. They have disputes with Philippines over islands. They have a notorious dispute with Taiwan over islands. they have disputes with, well, North Korea is kind of a proxy. China uses them as a wild card. But, you know, there's only so wild you can get. If you're trying to put pressure on South Korea, that's fine. But you can't pressure all these people at once when Uncle Sam takes notice. Now, I don't know whether this is a stroke of genius or whether the little red dragon got his panties in a bind, or what they've done to tick off so many people over there. You know, I don't know exactly. This could be the Japanese working their magic, because Japan is the, you know, helps out Vietnam a great deal. They give them all kinds of foreign aid, and in fact they give them more foreign aid than the United States. The United States just dishes out foreign aid in the area. And of course, Vietnam is getting weaponed up, as I call it. You know, they're getting weaponed up so they can steal like cornmeal. And guess who's selling them all their weapons? Guess who's sitting at Cam Ranh Bay spying on everyone? Well, it's okay. It's just Pooty Putin. Yeah, Vladimir Putin's cutting those big weapons deals with the Vietnamese. And Vietnamese are, they seem pretty easy going to me. You know, I mean, the ones that stay in their country, at least, they don't seem to be looking for problems. They don't seem to be all that aggressive. But the Chinese claim of this whole entire territory because, you know, their ancient emperors owned it or something along those lines. And the Chinese are also pissed off the Mongols. Mongolians are to the backside, border in between China and Russia. They've pissed off apparently everybody. And let's not forget the Indians. That's India. You know, China has never once invaded India in 4,000 years. They got the longest running border with India. The oldest border of between any two countries is the border between India and China. The Chinese have never once crossed it militarily. The Indians have crossed it several times. And the Indians are ticked off because China's kind of their rival in the area, in my opinion, based on their homogenous, the fact that China's homogenous, they would win out unless India got rid of a lot of people. But that's another story for another day. A lot of dead weight in India where China doesn't really put up with, they got some dead weight, but it's just not the same. But if you look at a map, you'll see what I'm talking about. And if you look up Blue Water Navy, you'll see quickly what I'm talking about. But China doesn't quite have the equipment most people think. They're in the first phase. And their first phase, this phase, is critical from about now until 2020. In 2020, they'll have serious capabilities if they keep up with doing what they're doing. In other words, they're just trying to build an aircraft carrier. They're trying to have a navy that goes around the world. Not that their navy doesn't sail to Africa now. It does. Not that their navy couldn't, elements of their navy couldn't sail to Los Angeles. They have a submarine fleet. Most of it's old. Some of them it's new. They're just learning how to operate in the deep seas. Not that they couldn't sail one to Los Angeles, but getting one there and being able to do anything with it is not one and the same. They're just starting to build aircraft carriers. They bought an old Russian carrier. They're studying how to build one. Building one is only half the problem. You got to learn to take off and land on one. It sounds easy, doesn't it? It's not. Most white rabbits, like the Russians, learned to do it by watching the Americans do it, and they lost a lot of pilots learning how. Everyone does. All white countries, when they get aircraft carriers, when they start building them, have challenges at first. It's just the way it goes. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, India should be able to field an aircraft carrier. They have some talent there at the top. Whether they could do it and take off and land and do all that without the British helping them, like the British do, I don't know. I don't know. You know, you got to do things from scratch to impress me. But saying you're going to do it, saying you're going to build three, and actually fielding three is another story for another day. China, on the other hand, has a serious population of computer savvy young ones. And they are pretty good hacking. They're not as good as the Russians. The Russians won all the awards for that, but they got numbers, and they should be able to get their numbers working for them somehow. They've talked about taking out a U.S. aircraft carrier by hacking into it. Well, they hacked into the Secretary of Defense for the United States. They hacked into his computer. China has some good hackers. They should be able to do something. But they're going to have to do something, probably soon from reading about these military maneuvers, because these things don't happen in a vacuum or by accident. So let's go over some, because some of these are so big that they ended up making Time Magazine, at least Time Online, in the July issue. And I have it tagged, and I wanted to bring it up to the audience, but I figured I'd wait to see if Fox News or MSNBC or anyone else talked about this, because these are huge events. The largest naval drills in the history of the world happened in July, have been happening over the past 90 days, 6 months, and no one's really talked about it. I think that's significant. What it says, and the time piece is labeled U.S. missiles deployed near China send a message. And America has all these Ohio-class submarines. And when it comes to submarines, most of these rabbits on the planet buy submarines. Yeah, they love buying Russia submarines. The first thing the Vietnamese are adding to their Navy are all these Russian submarines. I don't know how many they have right now, but they're buying billions worth. They just signed a contract with Russia. Or they have an open contract with Russia, because Russia's sitting at that famous Cameron Bay or whatever it's called there. Vietnam, but all these rabbits like buying submarines, and I don't know how many of them operate in the deep water, like that Hunt for Red October, if you've seen that movie where you got the Russians and the Americans going at it deep in the deep ocean. We're talking deep ocean submarine warfare. Well, White Rabbit's pretty much invented it and mastered it. I've heard that the Japanese have about 40, somewhere in that area, very sophisticated submarines they've bought from the Americans, and I heard they're very good at it, too. They're pretty savvy, but the Chinese are just learning how to do this. America, this is old news to us. You know, I mean, this stuff, like I said, America's Navy is so big, it's bigger than the next 12 on this planet, and you're generally comparing our Navy to white navies, the other white navies like Russia. Could Russia build a huge Navy? Sure. They had bigger ones at times. They don't for some particular reason, but we have this huge Navy in America. And they have these Ohio-class submarines, and those are called boomers. They have these modified boomers, we have 18 ballistic missile submarines, and 4 of the 18 no longer carry nuclear tip Trident missiles. Those are the missiles that can burn down the planet. Instead, they hold up to 154 Tomahawk cruise missiles each, capable of hitting anything within 1,000 miles with non-nuclear warheads. And also, Tomahawk cruise missiles can be equipped with nuclear warheads called W-80s. And they're called a kiloton. You just dial them up from a little nuke to a big nuke. And there's the Tomahawk is considered outdated to most white rabbits. Most white, if you go to, like, you got an uncle that knows everything about the military, he'll tell you Tomahawk's an old missile. They're coming out with a brand new one that has a 2,000 mile range. Well, what's outdated to white rabbits isn't really outdated to anyone else on the planet. Yeah, anyone else on the planet doesn't want to hear about these submarines showing up in their neighborhood, especially if you're in an argument with the United States, because it can mean anything. On these subs, you also have what it says in the Time magazine just goes, their capability makes watching these particular submarines especially interesting. The 14 Trident carrying submarines are useful in the unlikely event of a nuclear Armageddon, and Russia remains a prime target. But the Tomahawk outfitted quartet carries a weapon that the U.S. military has used repeatedly against targets in Afghanistan, Bosnia, Iraq, and Sudan. That's why alarm bells would have sounded in Beijing. So you have these submarines that pull up with all these Tomahawk cruise missiles at. They can sit back 1,000 miles, anywhere from 1,000 miles in, pop up out of the middle of nowhere and just start firing these things at you. And it's a pretty interesting asset for modern warfare. They'd probably be a lot better with these new Tomahawks they're bringing out, you know, that go 2,000 miles, but they don't have those out yet. So that's what they got over there. And these have been popping up all across East Asia just recently. They also have special forces on them. What's interesting about these 4 ballistic missile submarines that have been refitted, they carry like 60 special forces soldiers on each one, and you can drop them off anywhere to stir up trouble. Basically all these showed up On June 8, 2020, I'll read it to you. On June 28, when the Tomahawk-laden 560-foot USS Ohio popped up in the Philippines, I believe it's Subic Bay, S-U-B-I-C, more alarms were likely sounded when the USS Michigan arrived in Busan, South Korea, on the same day, and the klaxons would have maxed out on the USS Florida surfaced also on the same day at the joint U.S.-British naval base at Diego Garcia. So basically you had about 462 new Tomahawks deployed by the U.S. in China's neighborhood overnight. And it talks about Washington says there's been a decision to bolster their forces in the, bolster their forces in the area. And of course you have, and you have also all these military, all these naval maneuvers in the same way, and I'll go in the same area, and I'll go over that right now. The submarines aren't the only new potential issue of concern for the Chinese. Two major military exercises involving the U.S. and its allies in the region are now underway. More than 36 naval ships and subs begin participating in the Rim of the Pacific Games off Hawaii on Wednesday. Some 20,000 personnel from 14 nations are involved in the biannual exercise. And this one is one of the biggest ones ever seen. The nations joining the U.S. in what is billed as the world's largest ever naval war game are Australia, Canada, Chile, Colombia, France, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Netherlands, Peru, Singapore, and Thailand. You could pretty much walk across areas of the Pacific, jumping from ship to ship. That's how many there are. The pictures are wicked looking. They're just massive numbers of ships from all these countries. And not all those countries, I would say, are enemies of China, but a great many of them are ticked off. And let's go over another one closer to China called the Karat 2010. And that's C-A-R-A-T. It's a cooperation afloat readiness and training, and that just got underway off Singapore. Now this Karat, what I call the Karat, is billed as the kind of like the Asian version of NATO, the East Asian NATO, and that this one particular includes all the countries with the exception of what it looks like Vietnam, all the countries in the area that are kind of ticked off at China. Singapore, Bangladesh, and I don't know that Singapore is ticked off, but I'll get to something in a minute. Bangladesh, Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, and Thailand. Now, Vietnam is not in that one, but Australia, Japan, Indonesia, South Korea, and Vietnam have been encouraging the U.S. to push back on what they see as China's increasingly aggressive actions in the South China Sea. Now, Indonesia was just participating with the U.S. When the U.S. was in Vietnam, they had a big Vietnam drill separate from all these, with the Vietnamese Navy. Now, the Vietnamese Navy is nothing, it's not that big of a deal right now, but of course they're buying weapons from Russia, namely submarines, and they got lots and lots of soldiers. They're also really cheesed off at China. But Indonesian special forces were involved in that, and Indonesia, of course, is cheesed off at China. China is considered like the Jews of Southeast Asia. They dominate some of these countries and apparently are well hated. And they've been pushing their way around there, and the United States is, or someone is intelligent enough to let them create a problem for themselves. So you have these monster war games, and I'm not talking about the stuff going on near the Taiwan Strait. I'm not talking about how many carriers we have there. I know at least two. One of the jumbos is there. One of that new super carrier. They got all kinds of stuff running around in East Asia all of a sudden. And, we'll go over some more news reports here. Let's see, World Socialist website, this is a kind of funny site, The Dangers of Mounting U.S.-China Rivalry. And it talks about different factors in this from a socialist point of view. This is an interesting piece from LiveMint.com, a Chinese typhoon brews. Diplomatic turbulence in South China Sea brings into question the premise of China's peaceful rise. This is kind of from an Asian perspective. That the Asians are very leery of China. I'm going to repeat this title again because it's an interesting piece. A Chinese typhoon brews. I'm going to post some of these on my Twitter because I think they're interesting. And then you have another one from the AsianOne.com website, news site, Asia Busy in Arms Buying Spree. And it talks about all these different, the Malaysian deals, with France buying nuclear submarines. Vietnam is buying 6 Kegel class submarines and a dozen Su-30 MKK jet fighters equipped for maritime warfare. Australia is buying, all kinds of stuff. And into one of these drills, the Australians, interesting enough, I've got an actual video of an Australian submarine who they were basically practicing somewhere in the South Pacific. They were practicing with all these drills with the United States and in and around all this stuff going on. And the Australians released a video of one of their modern submarines hitting a target, an old target ship, a ship that they stripped down and made into a big floating target. Hit it with a torpedo. I had to catch my breath there for a second. Hit it with a torpedo, and it's a pretty epic video. It blew the thing right up. I didn't realize torpedoes were so powerful anymore. It split the thing in half and just crushed the thing. But they're doing all kinds of stuff. And it doesn't end. You know, you got these pieces. Let's see, the Zhong Ang Daily. This is the J-O-O-N Gang G-A-N-G Daily. Odd name. This is an Asian paper though. Big U.S. carrier joining Yellow Sea drill soon, and you can just look this stuff up. And this is stuff not being talked about anywhere. It's not really being talked about. The closest we can get is that the Washington Times has China targets U.S. troops with arms buildup, and what China's stated policy is, they want to influence Southeast and East Asia. They believe they own this area. And of course, a lot of people dispute that, but they want to do that. Another thing they realize they have to do is they can't, they use United States, our GPS system to guide their ships and stuff like that. Well, they can't be dependent on that. They got to build their own GPS system. And that is, of course, that is nowhere near complete. They should be able to see something over there. They should have satellites that can see something, but they're nowhere near where they want to be. But their goal is to push us out of that area and dominate this area and then use their mercantile abilities to dominate the world. They want to dominate the world through trade and mercantile. And if you're dominating the world through trade, it doesn't matter whether you're British Empire or the Chinese, the empire the Chinese want. You got to have a navy, and you got to have a blue water navy, some type of navy that can go everywhere in the world, because, you know, no one's going to protect your ships like you are. You know, China sends out goods all over the planet, and really they're dependent on the U.S. to protect that. Well, that's not really good business, so I understand China's point of view. The problem for China in the first phase is what they've claimed in East Asia and Southeast Asia, especially Southeast Asia. They've ticked off too many people. So are they targeting U.S. troops with our buildup? As well as they can. As well as they can. They're by no means ready to start fighting wars this big. They're just not ready. You know, it sounds easy to fly a jet you bought from Russia years ago with a big sunburn missile and take out a carrier. But you got to get within 300 some miles. You got to get there without them seeing you, and then you've got to actually hit the thing without them having countermeasures, which they may have for those older sunburns right now. Those old sunburn missiles by Russia are pretty much they're carrier killers, they're ship killers, if you can hit one with it. Now, normally, maybe that's easy, but when it comes to U.S. Navy, it's easier said than done. We won't see something like that happen until it does, but even if you were to take out a carrier, it's most likely just going to tick someone off. I mean, you know, where are you going to go with that? I guess you took down a carrier, you get a cookie. There's 10 more you got to worry about. And there's a whole lot of missiles that will be coming directly your way shortly thereafter, maybe even a nuke. So, you know, the problem is they're export dependent. And being export dependent, they need a navy. They ain't got a navy, so they got to build it. I understand their point. It's nothing to get upset over. The problem for them is they've ticked off a lot of people in the area, and someone's looking to take advantage of that. The Chinese are basically, you know, there's two sides inside China, and China is very difficult to figure out. In fact, all of East Asia, in my opinion, is difficult to figure out. There's two sides. There's a pink rabbit bankster and a leaster side, and there's a side that is, they do business with the white rabbits. The difference comes in, and if you look at the policies between Japan and China. But China has this public central bank. And there's one thing the red hippo doesn't like is you can't have a public central bank. That's always good attention. Every time someone puts one up on this planet, it doesn't matter whether it's the Founding Fathers and their colonial script. Yeah, the Founding Fathers had public central banks. They issued currency at interest-free, like a public central bank always does. You get attacked. If you're Nazi Germany and you put up a public central bank, a Reichsbank, and issue Reichmarks at interest-free, you will get attacked. And so the Chinese have themselves a public central bank, and they're calling for America to issue a true currency. And I've talked about this before. That reads like the grapes of wrath. And so the first question is, why is China, with so many pink rabbit banksters and leasers running around, well, how did they get away with this for so long? Well, public central banks tend to grow a country a lot faster and a lot more efficiently than private. Private central banks are a dead-end game. And the pink rabbit banksters and leasers love dead-end games because it puts them on top permanently. A private bank issues what I consider money. They don't issue it. They loan money into circulation. If you pull up a Federal Reserve note, it's just that. It's a note. The flaw is that a bank can only loan the principal. They have no way to deal with the interest. And the system's fundamental flaw is that the interest is always going to outpace the number of notes in circulation because of the compound nature of interest. In other words, there's always going to be a shortage on some level of notes. If you look at the U.S. money supply, it'll go through the roof. I mean absolutely through the roof, but so will the interest on the debt. It'll always outpace it. It's the nature of the beast. You can do some things like they did in the 1950s and balance the budgets, but they run their course. Well, the Chinese, for some reason, wanted to stick with this public central bank. Go figure. That's a no-no. Why they allowed it in the first place? I don't know. Maybe they talked them into it. Maybe they said they'd do it to see how fast they'd grow. I don't really know. But we'll go into some more different reasons because the conspiracy theories are buzzing, and I'll keep you abreast of the latest and greatest. And they all deal with financial markets in China. Let's go over some more news events. I'll come back to this point. Former foes, U.S.-Vietnam stage joint naval exercise. This is all headlines news. And you have the USS George Washington there hanging out with the Vietnamese after it was tooling around with the South Koreans. Let's see here. This is Global Research by Lai Jing. Friendly siege of China? U.S. submarines reach Asia ports. If you look at the map I laid out earlier, it's just a basic map. You realize the military exercise, the naval exercise going on. You realize that there's a ring around China. A total ring around China. You realize the type of submarines. The U.S. doesn't have to let you know they have submarines in the area, but they're finding out that all these submarines are in their area intentionally, coming out of nowhere. And China, of course, they do big business with the Jew rabbits, and they've actually been burned over that. It's come out that the Jew rabbit sold the Chinese a bunch of weapons, and it's kind of a funny story, and ticked off the American elites, which the Jew rabbits tend to do to no end when it comes to doing side deals and double dealing. Well, what they did was they turned around and they bought these drones, or were given these drones. Yeah, American taxpayers gave them these drones called Harpy drones. And they were going to, they sold them to China. And they were going to refit them. Israel was in the F-35 jet fighter program, or wanted to be in the new F-35 jet fighter program. And then, of course, China sends back all these Harpy drones to be refitted and updated and modernized. This was sometime in the mid-2000s, maybe 2003, 2005, something like that. And it became a big scandal. And so Israel was actually going to do that and expected to get away with it. And the U.S. cut them out of the F-35 deal and made them not do it and basically broke them in half and spanked them over it. Well, the funny thing about the Chinese is there's two sides in China, and I don't know which sides did it. Someone I respect on the Asian question is always old Bob Whitaker, and he's always said there's elements in China, and everything that you think the Jews are good at, they're as good at it, if not better, which means they're good at shystering, they're good at double dealing and everything else. But anyways, these Harpy drones that the U.S. military got ticked off that they gave the Israelis and the Israelis sold to the Chinese. Guess where they ended up on display just recently? They ended up in a military parade in, of all places, Iran. And I just had to tell you that. Yeah, you know, selling Chinese weapons is very dangerous. There's two sides in there, and they don't really care about the Jews too much. Depending on what side you get in, on what day you catch them. One side will certainly screw them over. But anyways, these little Harpy drones are on display, and U.S. military was teased off about that, and so were the Israelis. You know, here they saw this rising, this little red dragon, China, and they thought, well, maybe we'll go over there and do business, and all of a sudden you have all these weapons. And, of course, if the Chinese sold them Harpies, Harpies are anti-radar drones. You can look them up. And who knows what else they can be modified to do, but they're cool-looking little things. I'm looking at one right now with Ahmadinejad sitting there. And they've been doing this. This goes back to 2006 and all kinds of other stuff. But who knows what else they sold them? Who knows what on earth they sold Iran? But you get the picture. The Chinese can be cutthroat. The problem is that they are well hated in their neighborhood. And there's been a lot of speculation on why now. Well, it's time for a big war. So I'm going to go over the speculation. I'm going to talk about, because it's very difficult to figure out. Let me give you a what you see is what you get in East Asia. Most of you have heard of the Japanese crime syndicate, the Yakuza. They're kind of like a mob, except a lot more organized, in my opinion, and a lot bigger. You know, the only thing bigger over there would be the triads. But the Yakuza go back to 50 BC and, of all places, China. These two sides are very difficult to understand in exactly what's going on, other than the basics. China has a ring around it, and someone's getting ready to do something. The trend is toward they're doing something, and it's going to be against China. Just like there's a trend in the Middle East. Yeah, there's a very entrenched trend that they're going to do something in the Middle East. Now, when it happens or how it happens, I don't know. But you don't do these type of naval exercises. You don't do these type of things for no reason. And the messages they're sending to the Chinese are pretty over the top in regards to missile drills, in regards to the coordinated drills between the South Koreans, the Japanese. The Vietnamese, obviously, there's someone sending a very big message. And we'll go over some of the different theories on what the little red dragon got himself into. But basically, he created a problem for himself. And the pink rabbits have been known to cannibalize their own. The Anglo-American elite, the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters at the top of the Anglo Empire are top of the pink rabbit chain. And they're like, they're like the head of the mafia in America. You guys have watched all these movies and seen all around the world they know about the mafia in America. Well, imagine the Chicago mob is the top of the mob. The Chicago mob is even bigger than the New York mob and the New Jersey mob. Well, this little New Jersey mob is an upstart. And the New Jersey mob starts taking a shot at the Chicago mob, but they're nowhere near ready for that. Now, not that they're going to draw blood, but they want their business and everything else. Well, you're not ready for that, and you're going to get smacked. You're going to get punished. You're going to get beat up. You know, that's the way it works. They're like mobsters. That's the only way I can describe it to you. But I'll go over some of the fascinating different theories coming out on why they're doing this. Because there's two areas in the world that have defied Pink Rabbit. One is this public central bank that's a monster in China that's working very well for the Chinese. And that's a no-no. Those always get attacked. Another thing is Iran is defying, pink is defying the Red Hippo's energy policy. His energy policy is oil and coal unless you're white. If you're white, you can have a nuclear reactor. Or if you're on his good side, like the Indians in India, you can have a nuclear reactor. But in general, he does not like the fact, obviously, that Iran has a nuclear reactor. And we're going to talk about that next. But there's been all these theories on why all this stuff against China, because you haven't heard about it unless you start looking it up on what they're going to do to China. And I'm getting asked questions a lot from the white nationalists want to know if I'm afraid of China. No, I'm not afraid of China. China's more afraid of us than we are of them. It's not 2020, it's not 2050, it's 2010. They have limited capabilities. They should be able to do something. But then again, it wouldn't be the first time my race has built up a big red dragon that ends up being just a little paper dragon. We always make out other races to be something they're not because we compare them to us. It becomes a habit, and we always overestimate other races' capabilities and underestimate our own. But they're a far cry from being able to roll up and invade Australia. You know, you got to get there first. You got to unload your ships, and everyone in between has to allow it. It's easier said than done. But someone appears to be putting a crimp on this little red dragon. He stepped out of line. He's done something. The Pink Rabbit banksters and elitesters there made big moves, big quickly, and didn't back down, or aren't preparing to back down. But they are building nuclear bunkers. Interesting enough, there's more nuclear bunkers built supposedly in China over the past 36 months. Anywhere else in the world. But we're going to go over this with you. I'm going to go over a few different scenarios, and I don't fully know the whole score, other than something big is going on there, and it involves naval maneuvers, and it involves a lot of troop movements as well. I mean, you got some big armies over there, none of them white, but all of them want a shot at the Chinese. You've got people all around China, even to the back, like the Mongols, who are landlocked with them in Russia, that are ticked off at the Chinese. There's a group in China that's pretty much pissed off everybody. Kind of reminds me of the Jews in the Middle East. But anyways, we're going to go over a couple of these with you, because a couple of them are fascinating. Now, the latest and greatest conspiracy theory, or what we will call alternative news, involves a famous family in China called the Li or the Li's. It's considered a clan. Others consider them a caste. They're related to an ancient Chinese emperor that brought in paper money to China. In other words, he brought in private banking, private central banking. And one of these characters ended up working for, I don't know whether he was a doctorate in economics, but he ended up working for a famous Canadian bank owned by Pink Rabbits. And his Pink Rabbit family, or family he's connected with in China, the clan or caste he belongs to, basically is the famous Li family, or Li family, I don't know how you want to pronounce it. And basically he is famous for coming out with a little formula. The formula is become as famous as E equals MC squared, which was Einstein's formula. The formula allowed something. It allowed the pricing of collateralized debt obligations, CDOs. And the pricing of the collateralized, these pools of loans, these CDOs, and all this other stuff that came out in the past, I don't know, 15 years in America, all these crazy instruments, it allowed the pricing of it. And I can't go into too many details because I don't fully understand it. But what I do understand, that it allowed the growth of the collateralized CDOs. And the growth of the CDOs helped another thing grow a great deal. And that's the mortgage market, the U.S. mortgage market. If you've heard about these zero down mortgages and all that crazy stuff going on during the housing boom, that was all by and large because of CDOs. Without CDOs, that couldn't have happened. But he invented the formula that allowed all that. And right now he's sitting in a government office. He works for the People's Bank of China. You know, he works for that big central bank over there. What happened? Well, he left Canada very quickly once it went bust. But the word is that that there was an internal mob rivalry, that the Chinese Pink Rabbit banksters and elitesters in China wanted to take out elements of the Anglo-American elite. And so they set it up, an elaborate, not necessarily a con, but and it sounds too over the top to be true to me, but it's what's going on. I'm going to tell you about it. That basically he set them up, that he brought out this formula that they knew was severely flawed and flaunted it, and knowing that they'd go for it, you know, it exasperated. There was going to be a real estate bust in America and the world no matter what, in my opinion. But the CDOs and the mortgage stuff seriously exasperated it. And that's what they're accusing them of, that they exasperated it and they did this intentionally. They're trying to take them out. Which is fascinating. Fascinating stuff. I don't know how true it is. My first instinct is not to believe it because it sounds too elaborate, too over the top. At the same time, it's pretty simple. Develop a formula that they'll go for that'll screw them over. It wouldn't be the first time they got burned, but they do get even. Yeah, you don't go against a Chicago mob unless you're ready to go against a Chicago mob. It's nothing you're going to do and run away from it. And so that's the theory, that they're going to get even with them. I don't necessarily buy that. I'm passing it around because you've never heard that before. There's another theory. It's far more interesting, and it makes sense, that the Red Hippo has to make moves. Because the Red Hippo has to make moves, he's got to go for a new world order. And to go for a new world order, that means as Pink Rabbit banksters and elitesters all have to get in line. They don't have time to build up China. They don't have time to run their game, you know, destroy America, then move everything to China. That takes time. That's wonderful for 2050. It's funny how they always use this word 2050. And when you look up the stuff about white rabbits going extinct, it's always 2050. Well, they don't have 2050, apparently. They have right now. So they got to consolidate stuff. And if you know anything about the country best prepared for a new world order, well, that's America, because they got the military, they got the world reserve currency, they got everything going for it. But they can't have China screwing around, so China's going to have to give it up, and they're going to have to take them out. And in other words, instead of moving everything to China and fooling around and screwing around and playing their game like they like to play about, you know, destroy France and destroy Spain, move everything to France and consolidate power in Spain, and then and to do the same to France eventually, they don't have time to play all these games. So they're going to take out China. Well, that's interesting. That makes sense to me because they're pressed for time. And there's an off-the-wall example of this I'm going to go into next regarding, of all things, King Tut. That has to do with another timeline, the timeline that they're apparently concerned about. And that's in the next year, year and a half, 2012, this famous date. And so there's all these different theories about why now. Why are they getting interested now? Well, Japan has always been interested. Japan doesn't like certain Chinese elements, to say the least. Other elements are very cool with. My opinion, I don't think there's certain castes in China. They call them castes or clans that are only loyal to the Chinese emperor. This stuff goes way back. The Yakuza was formed 50 BC in China. Well, it goes way back. And the Asian listeners will tell the white rabbits that our stuff goes back even further than theirs. But they got all this stuff going around, and the Chinese have done quite well for themselves. But they've ticked off a lot of people. If there's anything that our enemy excels at, it's stoking ethnic conflict, especially inter-ethnic conflict, and taking advantage of opportunities like this. At the same time, there's so much going on that I don't know that they're just not looking to go for a world, new world order and knock out China. And I don't know that the Chinese elites wouldn't be in on it, although I doubt it. It's probably some combination of things if they actually do it. And I've been asked by the Asian listeners because they have the maneuvers on their doorstep. It's pretty hard to ignore if you're in Asia, obviously. This stuff is huge. These are the biggest naval games in the history of the world. So they have all this stuff on the doorstep. Do I think they're going to go for a decapitation? Now, decapitation is a military term that the U.S. can do to pretty much anyone on the planet except Russia. And they all war game decapitations on China, and a decapitation is simply an overwhelming strike, a nuclear strike, a first strike option. China does not have a first strike option. In fact, they have an anti-first strike option. They will not take a first strike in their constitution. And, of course, many cynics believe that's just because they can't do it. Probably true. But the United States has a first strike option on everybody, with the exception of Russia. In other words, if we had to take someone out, they could take them out. Doesn't mean there'd be a lot of radiation. There would certainly be some, but we have low radiation options. It means that the place would get wiped out. You know, they take the head off and let it flounder a little bit. And this first strike option, they've wargamed very successfully against the Chinese. You know, they put on a first strike of some type. Take out their command and control, just take everything out, and just an overwhelming strike. And into that, of course, China is going to put up so many of their nukes. They don't have that many nukes, but they have enough to put up, and all their nukes get shot down. And if you know anything about the current defense, you know that all over the world, they are practicing shooting down stuff. Not just the U.S. Navy, the Netherlands, they have Aegis destroyers. All around the Netherlands, the Spanish have them. The Russians are testing out a new laser just in the last 2 weeks. And Russia has more sophisticated laser technology than supposedly America. I mean, they're all testing this stuff. What they're going to do with it, I'm not quite sure. Obviously, they're preparing to shoot something down. And in America, they've been testing this stuff successfully over the past 10 years, much more successful now than it ever has been. But they have all kinds of Aegis destroyers ringed around Southeast Asia and Asia, all in this ring around China. They have these Aegis destroyers, and some of them are owned by the Japanese. And the Japanese have a pretty decent navy. They got about 40 subs. They can stir it up. But you got all this there, and obviously they're there to shoot stuff down. They're not there for their health. But they war game this stuff, and it war games very successfully against everyone except the Russians. The Russians always seem to get you with something. Because the Russians have boomers out there. They have boomers that can fire missiles. You're not going to find them all, and you're not going to be able to kill them all before they take you out. So it's very costly trying to do a decapitation against Russia, do an overwhelming strike. And of course, that's why they wanted to put these missile bases around Russia. They wanted this as an option, but Russia's a little too wise to that. But the Chinese are nowhere near opposing it. They can't do anything about it if they wanted to do that. Now, I was asked, do I think they would do that? If they're pressed for time, and they have to do it, sure. I mean, they can do it. They can do it. They can do it. It's nasty stuff, but they can do it. Do I think they will? I have no idea. If they don't screw around with China, it'd be over with very quickly. If they screw around with them and they want some big bloody war for World War III, well, then of course it would get ugly. It would get ugly in Vietnam. It would get ugly everywhere. It would especially get ugly for China. But China should be able to do something. They should be able to shut down a new. They should be able to do something with all these hackers. Maybe. I don't know, but they're they're not ready to start invading Los Angeles and stuff like that. They certainly could sabotage something. You know, they're geared for sabotage within the Southeast and Northeast Asia. They're geared for hacking, especially in causing problems in these areas. They're geared for shooting missiles against fixed targets. But, you know, you've got these new Patriot batteries, the PAC-3s, that are a lot better than even I thought. Those are U.S. Patriot batteries, and those are all over the world now, too. All our allies have them. Japan has them around everything. So you got to be able to hit something. They should be able to do something. They should be able to knock out some runways. They should be able to target something. They should be able to get lucky somewhere. But you can't go against these types of... You can't go against all these different armies and navies at once. It's just too difficult. They're not ready for that. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I can just point out the obvious that big naval war games usually involve big naval wars. Maybe it'll be interesting. Maybe the Chinese will maybe make it interesting. Maybe they'll get taken out really quick. They don't have to play games with them if they don't. Most people don't think that these guys at the top of Anglosphere, if they get pressed for time, won't do a decapitation, won't just take out a country with some kind of low-yield nukes. They'll do it. They're capable of anything when they're afraid, and something's got them a little spooked right now. And in the next piece, I'm going to go over, and we're going to talk about what's going on in the Middle East, and I'll answer some questions on that too, because this decapitation, this first strike option that the U.S. has against everyone with the exception of Russia, successfully, in other words, they successfully war game it day and night. We're going to talk about that in regards to Iran and what the little Israelis, everyone's figured out what they're waiting for or why they're waiting on this Iran stuff. And we'll talk about that next. So before we move on, we really don't know what's going on in the Asian region other than huge naval war games. And everyone's jockeying for position and the groups are all cheesed off at China. And I don't know whether this little red dragon is going to get spanked, whether he's going to get himself in trouble, whether it's been set up by the Japanese, whether he just stepped over a line and is going to get taken out, whether he's going to get cannibalized because the pink rabbit banksters and leasers will eat their own if they step out of line. I don't really know. We'll have to sit up and watch. And when it comes to decapitation and stuff like that, it really doesn't, you know, the idea that they would try something like that doesn't make anyone very comfortable because, of course, we're sitting in America and we're not sitting in nuclear bunkers like the elites. So, you know, obviously war games are one thing, but to know that they're going to do that, do something crazy like that, and China most likely will get off some nukes. But I'm guessing they're not testing all these missile defenses for no reason. But if you're going for a new world order right now, there's only one country, there's two countries you must have. One is America, and you better have either a deal or something going on with the Russians. And of course, the Russians and the Germans are doing what during this whole time? They're doing nothing but weaponing up, gunning up everybody. I mean, they're selling weapons to everyone under the sun. They're selling weapons to all sides. They are. It doesn't matter whether it's Israelis getting German subs or the Iranians, you know, for all I know, elements that like Russia and Germany and China may have been told by them to sell stuff to Iran because they could get away with it. For all I know, they could be doing stuff like that. That makes sense to me, but I don't know. But now we're going to go over to the Middle East, and so we'll watch that area develop. And I've listened to you guys, and I will post some of the news pieces I'm getting. I will post them directly to Twitter in regards to China, and you can go through and read them yourself and form your own opinions. I just noticed trends. And this China stuff is all of a sudden. Now, in all fairness, a lot of these groups have been ticked off at China going on now a while as China gets more and more arrogant. And it's really stupid stuff on China's part. You got these young soldiers and they've been indoctrinated. The Chinese Navy, they've been indoctrinated. They're driving around in brand new ships and China's buying and building some pretty nice stuff. And they're pushing people around because they've been indoctrinated. And their indoctrination is very, very weird. If you've ever seen any Chinese, overseas Chinese that are heavily indoctrinated, they're nationalistic, but they pursue it from a victim's mindset. And that's always dangerous. That's the gateway to pink rabbit thinking. The gateway to what some call the pink rabbit mindset. It starts out a victim, that everything in their history that's been done to them is someone else's fault. That they had this big empire, but people screwed them over, and everyone, they never do anything wrong, basically. And so when you have these naval guys with a big chip on their shoulder, in these nice new Navy ships running around toppling Philippine fishermen, pushing around the Vietnamese, well, they all get ticked off. There's nothing really any of them can do. But boy, you could gather them up one day and, the U.S. Navy and Air Force, could help them out, and they sure could do a whole lot. They got flip-flops on the ground. but it's just bad business to run around toppling over fishermen boats and to do it out of spite because you're Chinese and they're Filipino and they're worthless animals and you actually own all their island and you descend from emperors and the whole game. But it's this victim mindset. It's a very weird nationalist mindset. And I see this in the Israelis too. Some Israelis, some Jews. They never do anything wrong and everything in their history is someone else's fault. you're gonna end up doing pretty destructive things if you start thinking like that, and that's what's happened to the Chinese. I've seen it on the bulletin boards. I've seen it from the comments from the Chinese nationalists, but you don't really see it until you hear the Southeast Asians start talking about them. This is an interesting coalition that's been put together. And anytime you could put a coalition of against anyone really. And it's inter-ethnic conflict, like the Asians will go at it. It's not a good day to be around. If the Anglo elites team up with the Russians to go against the Germans, you don't want to be the Germans. I mean, you're going to get beat up on. There's no doubt about it. And this stuff in Asia, these guys go at it like no tomorrow. So we'll have to watch it develop, and I'll keep you abreast of it because it's developing very, very quickly. And now we're going to move over to the Middle East. And now moving over to the Middle East, we have, all kinds of ships are in the area, around the area, out of reach of the Iranians, and the Russians are lighting that reactor. I've been emailed several times, people asking me, do I think they're going to strike it before the reactor? I have no idea. My guess is no. No, I think they're going to light the reactor any minute while I'm doing this, and I don't expect Israel to strike at all because I now know exactly what they're going for, the whole position, and it kind of makes sense. What they're going for is the way they're framing the debate, and I will put this up on my Twitter along with all the other pieces, is Christopher Hitchens lays it out quite well, and he's a neocon. He's pretty well-spoken. I don't particularly care for him or his views, but he makes them quite clear. And what he says is Iran is not worth a breakdown of international law. So we have to strike Iran before it comes out that they have a nuke, and then everything goes crazy, because once they have a nuke, all of international law will break down, and the Israelis are going to start doing whatever they want all over the area. And all over the area means all over the Middle East. And then it occurred to me that the UN dates toward late fall, early winter, we're talking October, November, December, that in the UN it's going to become clear that there is a potential breakdown of international law in regards to Iran. Iran is going to the edge of the law. They're not going over it. So are the Russians. The Russians are going to load up nuclear reactors, and the Russians have plans to do it with 10 or 12 of them. Why do the Iranians want nuclear reactors? Well, they want it for civilian electricity. It's cheap power. It's not a dead-end system, and it's not system Pink Rabbit banksters and elitesters can no longer control. They don't like it. They like dead-end systems. They like oil and coal and stuff that they can control. Nuclear power gives countries like Iran cheap energy. Cheap energy means they grow a lot quicker. They don't like any of that. Why? I don't know. They got issues. We've already talked about their dead-end systems. It's conflict and scarcity. They love everything based on scarcity. So anyways, and this is ran afoul, obviously, of the Red Hippo doesn't like Iran. And Israel's screaming mad over this. But the big challenge is that the people that built the reactor, the Russians, the people that designed it, the Germans, as well as White Rabbits in general, generally have an approach to when it comes to whether anyone realizes it or not, we generally have a universal approach to our weapons, to our technology. We have one that the whole world sees, and we have another one that everyone knows is there, but you're not going to see it until it's too late. In other words, you got black projects. We have it in all areas of technology. We always do. The only ones that don't really think about it like that are White Rabbits. We don't even realize it. Yeah, most White Rabbits don't even know America has a black budget, much less that it's huge. It's huge. That's just what's known. Yeah, they don't really realize that. We don't see B-2 bombers until they show up on our doorstep. We don't see stealth bombers until it's too late. That's just the way White Rabbits operate. If you were in their position, you'd operate the same way. But it is widely thought that Iran has that for their nuclear program, which would only make sense compared to the people that set it up. The Russians and the Germans, especially the Germans. I mean, if they act like that, well, everyone else in the world starts acting like that. The Chinese, they have a black weapons project there. They have to. Everyone does. Everyone copies White Rabbits. But anyways, it's widely thought that Iran has this. They have it deep underground. There's these tunnels that run the whole part of Iran, these huge underground tunnels. They're quite ancient, some of them. And they're deep. And it's widely thought that they have stuff going on down there. And I'm sure they do. It makes good sense. It's nothing that America wouldn't do. It's nothing anyone else wouldn't do. And listening to the Hitchens interview, the way he framed it of a breakdown of international law, and some of the stuff the Israelis have been talking about going on late fall at the UN, is that it's going to become clear that there is a breach one way or another. And most people assume that the Israelis wouldn't want that, or that they wouldn't want Iran to have a nuke. You see, the day Iran has a nuke, and it gets known that they have a nuke, is the day international law is null and void to someone like Israel. Is the day Israel can go wild. And they love going wild. I mean, they're Bolsheviks. They're nuts. And it's occurred to a lot of people that that's what they're going for. They're going for a breakdown of international law. That's what they want. Now, what is the United States doing? Well, the United States, the New World Order crowd, doesn't want a breakdown of international law. They want to keep the order status quo. And so what they are doing, cutting deals with the Russians, although that didn't, you know, it hasn't worked out so well, but they're cutting deals with the Russians, and the Russians are taking away the fissile material, and they're basically, the Iranians are not keeping the material to make a nuclear bomb. The Russians are taking it out of there and helping them dispose of it and everything else, so they say. But basically, what they're doing right now is cutting deals. And what the Israelis want is they want one of two things. One, either international law breaks down, and given time, this fall it will. Things are starting to break down. Now, international law only really counts for White Rabbits, except when it comes to White Rabbit genocide. No one else in the world really pays attention to it. But in reality, I shouldn't really say that. Most people do pay attention to it. Most people do obey it. Except in regards to their neighbors. You know, international law is funny stuff. White Rabbits enforce it against White Rabbits, but we let it slide against a lot of others. But what the Israelis want, they don't really like these laws. Although they were big in passing all these genocide laws and all this stuff like that, they were at the forefront of passing it after the Holocaust. They don't really like all these laws anymore. They hold them back, which is kind of common sense. And the UN has all these Tempok dictators, and they don't like any of that. They want to get rid of all that because it doesn't suit their agenda anymore. And so what they've said to the United States, I know exactly what they said, is they want the decapitation. You see, if Israel goes in and, say, strike Iran, that's going to be extremely ugly. I mean, if they go it alone, that's going to be ugly, and they're going to get hit with the package immediately, and it's going to be beyond ugly. However, if they can get the red hippo to do a decapitation, to do a limited decapitation, it would be very, very ugly, but it would lessen the aftermath. Oh, Israel's going to get hit with a package, but it would lessen it a great deal, as any big strike would. Now, could they hit a live civilian nuclear reactor? No, it's against international law. But this is a die deal they're toying with, the breakdown of international law. The Russians have toyed with this, too. What happens when international law doesn't mean anything? Well, you go back to dealing steel like cornmeal, you go back to the Wild Wild West, we go back to playing basketball. Any listener of this podcast knows all about basketball. We don't play basketball now. It's illegal on the planet. But if that were to happen, Israel would, of course, wipe out the Palestinians, and they would start seeking revenge in the area by any means necessary. If you know anything about the Bolshevik Revolution, you know they can be quite dangerous, especially with some of the weapons they have. One could only imagine. And so they're wheeling and dealing around these topics. And what's interesting, it appears that the Israelis want this decapitation, or they're threatening the breakdown of international law, which may happen as soon as, October. And if that happens, well, then we're going wild. Because if it comes out that they have nukes, and a lot of people think they do, a lot of people think they do have something, that Iran has something up their sleeve. If it comes out, or if a certain scenario happens at the UN, even in regards to these sanctions, and there's a breakdown of international law, Israel's just threatening. They're saying we're going to do whatever to survive. And if you look at the Hitchens interview, you'll see it coming out. You know, if we don't strike Iran, international law is going to break down, and then Israel is going to do whatever they can to survive in the area. And who knows what the hell that means. And so this is what they're playing for. And what the U.S. has put together, what Talibama, the team Talibama has put together, Pink Rabbit Banksters and Leasers, is, you see, the biggest party behind the scenes that wants a strike against Iran, it's not just the Jews, it's the Saudis. You got this big Shia crescent forming across the Middle East. And now the Shia, if you look at global Islam, it's not that big of a deal. But in the Middle East, it's almost 50-50. Yeah, the Sunnis dominate global Islam, but the Shia dominate the Middle East now. And they're scared to death. The Saudis are scared to death of the Persians. And they have reason to be. Because Ahmadinejad has said that the Saudis have no business being on the holy sites. I mean, grapes of wrath. And they really wouldn't have any way to oppose them. And so, of course, the Saudis complain to Uncle Sam, and they sell their oil to the Red Hippo because they don't have a choice. But they're part of Team Pink Rabbit. I'm talking about the Saudis, the guys at the top of Saudi royal family. They're Team Pink Rabbit. And so they and the Jew rabbits have this quartet that they're going to have to do something against Iran because they got this nuclear power and all these other problems. And what they want also is a decapitation because they don't want to get hit with the package. And so they're going at it like this. Team Talibama tells the Israelis, fine, you want that, you're going to have to give me something. Well, what do you want? You know, Netanyahu, he's like, you're a hardliner, you're a conservative, you're going to have to give the Palestinians a state. Now, at first blush, most people would say a hardliner wouldn't do that. Well, a hardliner is the only one that get away with it. Now, what does he get out of it? Maybe he gets a decapitation against Iran or a war, or they're going to help you with a war with Iran or take Iran out. And, of course, the Saudis immediately are asked to give up something, too. You see, the Saudis can't do anything with Islam as it stands until they do something with the Palestinian issue, or they'll look weak. And so they turn around, the Saudis say, now that the Israelis are going to do that, you're going to have to nip this in the butt, nip this in the butt, nip this in the butt. And with the Palestinian issue solved, you should be able to do that no problem. And will the Saudis and the Israelis listen to them? Absolutely. Absolutely. So I expect there to be a lot of deal cutting over what they're going to do with Iran. They're not going to do it for free, but that's what they're going for. And Israeli does have somewhat of a stick. If international law breaks down, we're going wild. It's going to be Pink Rabbit going wild. And we can hit nuclear reactor. I mean, nuclear right now you can't hit the Iranian nuclear reactor without being on the wrong side of international law. It doesn't mean you can't decapitate the place, go in there and shut the thing down. You see the point. And of course, what they're going to say is, look, once international law breaks down, we can hit anything we feel like hitting. And we're not going to sit here and take him mouthing off to us. And you know how, anyone listening to this should know how the Israeli elites are. They're very arrogant and they're not entirely crazy, but they can be. And a breakdown of international law would serve them quite well, because then they could get rid of the Palestinian problem. They could get even with the other sides of the Team Pink Bankster. That's the Saudis. They don't like the Saudis. Some of them, you know, the Team Pink Rabbit has all these contentious relationships all over the world. And, of course, the Russians and the Germans are sitting back watching this and selling weapons to everybody. But that is what they're going for. That is the delay. They're going for this ultimatum. And they're going to, the elements of the Republicans, namely the neocons, are going to use this as a big stick in American politics, you know. You know, either you support Israel or you're a terrorist, that type of thing. They want this. Another thing the Israelis like is that the Israeli leadership likes keeping their population in fear. And the Jews did this all during the their time in Europe. They used to have the population scared to death of the Gentiles. You know, they're stuck in the ghetto and they think everyone's out to get them. And then they're surprised when everyone's out to get them. Go figure. But that is what they're going for. Now, timelines, I don't have timelines. I've heard little birdie had told me this stuff will not go until late in the end game. In other words, this is going to be last to go. Now, when does this start? I don't know. We're on the eve of it, though. I've heard Israel wants to do it. Some say October, some say next spring. Pretty in the near future. October is only 2 months away. Next spring is only a handful of months away, 6 months away or so. Very interesting stuff. I don't know other than the trend, but there's a lot of deals being cut. And most don't think he'd cut a deal long-term with the Palestinians. You're right. You're right. I mean, these guys are treacherous. But they sure as hell would cut a deal in the short term. He'll do whatever's possible. And, of course, there's always that other factor that the Red Hippo and his Pink Rabbit banksters and leasers are scared to death of something. They're absolutely terrified. So terrified, they're putting the package together, and they're willing to decapitate anyone. They're willing to put all these rabbits in line. Like Israeli, you have to, the Israeli rabbits, you have to do it or else. We're going to take you, you know, that type of ultimatum. And if they start giving ultimatums, they will listen. You know, when the Israelis were given ultimatums over the Harpy drones and told them they were going to get punished and kicked out of the F-35 program, it surprised a lot of people. But they did it, and it did happen to them. They were punished. They'll smack them on the nose if they have to. But this time frame coming into 2012 is fascinating and interesting because their timetable has always been sped up. Their timetable... the Red Hippopotamus' timetable is stretched out to well over 2050, at the shortest 2030, and now his timetable has moved into 2012. And a lot of strange events happened right after September 11, 2001. I'm going to go into one that I didn't know about until just recently, and has to do with King Tut, and we're going to go into that next. And this is one of the biggest events on this planet that no one knows about. It's fascinating stuff in regards to one of the largest museums ever being built, that's being built right now. And I'm going to go into that next. But there are all kinds of strange events going on between now and 2012, and a lot of especially in regards to off-the-wall stuff, like this museum that you don't know about, but yet you do. You know about some of the characters involved in the museum. And we're going to go into that next, but the point is that the trend is toward war, and no change equals no change. A Palestinian peace deal doesn't mean there's not going to be war with Iran. It means that they're bartering and telling the Saudis, this is what you wanted to get to get this stuff in line. You know, you need this to so you don't look soft for your Sunni population. And they're telling the Jews, this is what you're going to have to do. And if you do this, and your good little pink rabbits will decapitate Iran for you. Now, of course, they want to get Iran anyways because Iran is opposing their energy policy, basically. Now, of course, where the Russians fit into this, no one really knows. There are those that say that they've set up the whole entire Anglo-American elite, and I hope that's right. But you're witnessing everything go over the ledge, is what you are. I don't think anything will happen in August. I hope not. I can't imagine anything happening before they meet on September 2nd with the Palestinians. A lot of people think it's going to fall through. I don't. I think they're going to announce a landmark peace deal. And that'll be that is the agreement Israel had to agree to get the Red Hippo to strike Iran. And I think the Saudis are going to come online and start modifying things. Now, of course, that would take 15 to 20 years. They don't have that kind of time. So it should be interesting to see what else they got working. But in this next piece, And of course, as always, I'll keep you abreast of this, and I'll put up some look on my Twitter from time to time, and I'll put up some interesting points of view on this as we watch the scenario unfold. But that's what the Israelis are threatening. They're threatening what they're going to do if there's a breakdown of international law, and you're on the time on the planet where everything's falling to pieces. And you're also on a time where coming into this fall, this winter, there's going to be some interesting ultimatums at the UN in regarding to Iran. And God forbid it comes out one morning that they have a nuke. Because as soon as that happens, you're on a whole new planet in regard to the Jew rabbits will go nuts. Just because they have one nuke, does that mean the Israelis would be in danger? Maybe. Just because you have one, you got to hit them with it. And you've got a lot of different missile defenses in the area. It really depends. I'm of the opinion that if the Chinese actually land a nuke in Los Angeles, it's because one of the Pink Rabbit banksters and leasers wants it that way. That's my opinion, because they got a lot of missile defenses now. But the average Israeli would be scared to death, and that's useful for the Israelis. Netanyahu would not be in any danger. From Jewish history, they don't tend to care about Jews dying, in my opinion. They tend to do stupid things and get them killed. So I don't really know. There are some parties that believe that they want them to have a nuke, because that would be a clear breakdown of international law, and that's when they've been waiting for to deal with all these other issues that they can't deal with under international law. You know, it's kind of ironic. They lobby after World War II. They have all these crazy laws passed. The only ones that bay them are white rabbits, and now they're in violation of all these laws, and they want to get rid of them, which is typical Jew rabbit behavior, in my opinion, especially in regards to their elites. But in the next piece, I'm going to update King Tut. There's some fascinating stuff going on with King Tut and events that you don't know about. One of the largest architectural contests in the history of the world, what happened in 2002, right after September 11th, and the museum that's built, the museum that's in the process of being built, that was, they sped up its production. Production was moved back from 2015, 2013, all the way to 2012, and they're moving to it right now. And we're going to go into all this in the next one. Keep you guys on top of things. This museum is called the Fourth Pyramid. So we're going to go into this and the characters involved. It involves a famous young Egyptian pharaoh that they happen to just accidentally find all his goods. And that'll be coming up right about now. And now a word from our sponsor. Have you ever said to yourself, gee, I would love an undercover lover? Or maybe you said to yourself, gee, I would like to be an undercover lover. We know exactly how you feel. For a limited time only, on WhiteRabbitRadio.net, you can buy an undercover lover. You can be an undercover lover. Yes, for only 25 carats. It is a great investment because all the money goes to fight white rabbit genocide, which is the thing we're about here at WhiteRabbitRadio.net. So if you're looking for an undercover lover, or if you're looking to be an undercover lover, or if you're just looking to have the coolest undercover lover in the history of the undercover lovers, we have just the ticket for you, all at a very, very low price. Yeah, so hop on over there and pull up that merchandise tab. And when you see the undercover lover, you'll go wild at how beautiful it is. And hit that buy button. Support fighting white rabbit genocide in the easiest way possible. Be an undercover lover. On the 5th of November, 1922, a young man was found. He was found with all his loot, and that's the young King Tut in common. A lot has been made out of him simply because they found his gold. Or so we thought. We thought that was the only big deal with this young king. This young pharaoh of Egypt. But from the day Howard Carter found it, it's become pretty famous for one simple reason. They found all his gold. He's not really famous for anything else. Or so we are led to believe. And I've talked about King Tut before because the events surrounding him, his father was Akhenaten. The events around Akhenaten and the Hyksos are pretty mysterious. There's nothing significant about them other than our enemy pushes them night and day. Yeah, a part of their New World Order has been revealed. And I'm going to go over this, or at least we know the direction it goes, and it all surrounds King Tut. Zawi Hawass is the head of is an Egyptian archaeologist, and he's the vice minister of culture in Egypt. And he is Pink Rabbit Bankster and Elitester extraordinaire. And he's always said Egypt or the Egyptians were mixed. You know, he's asked if they're African. He said, no, they're not black. Are they white? No, they're not white. They're mixed. And, of course, I'll give you a little background on him. He had his PhD. He studied Greek and Roman archaeology at Alexandria University, where he obtained a bachelor's degree. And then he obtained a diploma in Egyptology from University of Cairo. And then in 87, he received a doctorate degree from the University of Pennsylvania, where he studied as a Fulbright scholar. And, you know, he's pretty famous. He runs around running his mouth, and he's got a show, Something with Mummies, or Chasing Mummies, that's what it is. And he's always pushing the Tut line, and many other parties are. It's rather dubious, because there's nothing really special about this kid other than they found his loot. And so it came out, they revealed a portion of Akhenaten's, a portion of his paternal DNA, or a portion of his father's DNA. And that portion of his father's DNA would lead anyone to believe, if they were going to roll dice, that his father was at worst part European and at best European. And a lot of people at the time were rather blown away by that. Now the European scientists keep on saying that, well, he could be just North African, because modern day North Africans are all, you know, all have the same whatever little splice of genes that they showed. A lot of North Africans have that, and that's true, because a lot of North Africans are part European. But I've said that King Tut is European, but his whole DNA is not known. There's some mysterious points in this. You see, they revealed two things about King Tut. One, his mother wasn't Nefertiti, and that's huge. I'll get back to this in a bit. But that his father was Akhenaten. They revealed his paternal DNA, which would make his father at worst part European. And it leads to even more questions. But there's another kicker, that the young Tut's mother was in fact Akhenaten's sister. So if you're looking at Akhenaten's DNA, and his DNA, if you're rolling dice, you would think he's part European at worst, by what's been revealed. Someone revealed a cross-section of his DNA, of Tut's paternal DNA, has a very, very high probability of being European. And everyone wants all the facts. Where the white archaeologists and the white scientists are kind of covering for it, they say, well, there's only a probability. Most of the non-European scientists and archaeologists are saying, well, this kid's, you know, we want all the facts, because there's a high probability these people are white. You know, Zawi Hawass has always walked around saying these people are mixed. And there's something up with this whole entire King Tut thing. But the big scandal was, of course, that King Tut's mother was not Nefertiti. His mother was, in fact, Akhenaten's sister, and this kid is all messed up. You know, they just happened to find all his loot, and they just happened to be building a giant new museum around him that you've never heard of, that I'm going to let you in on. But this became a big scandal. King Tut's DNA, but they didn't reveal all his DNA. In other words, for a fact that he was European, Indo-European. You wouldn't know for a fact that Akhenaten was Indo-European. They haven't released enough of the DNA, but what they did do was they released enough of the DNA to cause an uproar among archaeologists that want to know what the hell's the deal with these guys. And so I'm going to correct that. I said King Tut, we know for sure he was European. Well, we know for sure he's part. The whole story isn't out, and there's something wrong with this picture. Something's up with these characters. Now let me go into an event that took place in 92. In 92, they started shaping the Giza Plateau. They started shaping the Giza Plateau for this new this new museum called the Grand Egyptian Museum, and they've been apparently this has been in the works for a long, long time. However, they had a long-term plan on it, and their long-term plan on it got thrown for a loop one morning all of a sudden in 2002. And January 7th, 2002, they announced a competition. It was the largest architectural competition in the history of the world, as in the world as we know it. And it received like 1,557 entries. This museum is huge. It's a huge museum. It's on 50 hectares of land in Giza. And it's a couple miles from the pyramids. And of course, all of a sudden in 2002, after September 11th, these are key dates, post-1998, after September 11th, the very next year, they announced that this museum was going to start being built. And its first projected date was 2013 to 2015, which, of course, would have been pretty fast. Well, they've now moved up the date. The date was moved up to 2013 at the latest, and now, of course, they're confirming that it'll be done by 2012, and as of right now, they're already moving into it. And this massive, massive museum, it's called the Fourth Pyramid. It's pretty cool looking. It doesn't look like an actual pyramid that we think of, but it's pretty cool design. It was designed by an architect called Hennigan Ping. And Hennigan Ping is from Dublin, Ireland. It looks like a Chinese man and an Irish woman who own an architecture firm there. But anyways, they're building this museum. And the centerpiece of the museum is, guess what? King Tut. King Tut's on display at the museum. He's a whole entire centerpiece of the museum. They have these little modern electric cars. And you remember President Talibama went over to Egypt, and he hung out around there. But they didn't show him at this museum. This museum is one of the largest things being built on this planet. I think it's one of the most expensive museums ever, $550 million, because they're building at such breakneck speed to get it done by 2012. And they are moving into it right now. Zahi Hawass has his new office there. They're tearing down any little old hut on the Giza Plateau to build this thing. And it's going to be the centerpiece. So here you have a massive museum all centered around King Tut, this nobody pharaoh. Very strange stuff. And you have a museum that out of the blue, they had a plan for quite a while. No one knew what was going to be in it, but, you know, Egypt's got a lot of old stuff. They probably need some new museums. But they started shaping the land in 92, and 10 years later in 2002, at breakneck speed, they announced this big architectural contest, and they've been hurrying up building it. I mean, it's building the thing at breakneck speed, and they're building it in a desert. So I'm guessing you could probably get something built fast in the desert if you wanted to throw enough money at it. It's not like they have a winter and stuff like that. But it's really fascinating stuff that all they've been putting this thing together, and now they've moved up the date when it's going to be done to all the way to 2012. It's fascinating, and no one even talks about this. Grand Egyptian Museum. King Tut is the centerpiece. And there's, you know, you can look it up. It's just the Grand Egyptian Museum, and you can read all about it. It's got these cool little electric cars they're going to take from the museum all the way over to the pyramids. And it's got all kinds of stuff. I mean, it is a serious looking museum. You've never seen anything quite like it. And all this is happening at breakneck speed, as well as these big wars that are shaping up, or we could say potential big wars. We don't know there's going to be big wars until they happen, but potential for big wars are shaping up. Not only in the Middle East, but in Asia, and you got this big museum being built on the Giza Plateau. The biggest thing to be built there since the pyramids. You'd have to look it up. And they're moving into it right now. But the story gets even more interesting in the incidents surrounding King Tut. Now let's go back. Let's go back that his mother ends up not being Nefertiti. Tutankhamun's mother is in fact Akhenaten's sister. What is known that he's at worst part European, and they're all messed up. Akhenaten was upside down. Akhenaten is so upside down that if you're watching Ancient Aliens on the History Channel, he will stick out. he sticks out so much in Egyptian history for being so backward, so upside down, that on Ancient Aliens, many people, it made it all the way there that he was an alien or part alien. In other words, he's so backwards, the rumors have spread so far and wide that they actually put him on Ancient Aliens. I don't know if you guys have ever watched that show. I got listeners that watch that type of thing. It's pretty fascinating stuff that the rumors about him being an alien would make it all the way there. Obviously, someone's spreading the word on something. Something's up with this guy. I don't know that he's an alien. Some of my listeners believe he actually had one of those little bug-eyed gray aliens, like a demon possession. Have you ever seen the movie Stargate or something like that? The movie Stargate has that little gray alien that sits in that man. It pretty much sits in him like a parasite in a host. It's pretty wild stuff. But the rumors about Akhenaten just abound. I mean, he's so backward he ended up on Ancient Aliens as a potential alien or part alien. Something's messed up with his equation, and their whole entire New World Order is centered around these events around Akhenaten's and the King Tut's, and of course their whole entire museum. He's going to be the centerpiece. The full story with it, I don't know, but apparently there's some big problems when it comes to Nefertiti. Now Nefertiti has an interesting story in herself. And she's like King Tut in a way that we don't know anything about her. We don't know, in fact, we even know less. We don't know anything about her history. We don't know anything about where she came from. We don't know if she was even Egypt or she's from some ancient Aryan dynasty. Now, we don't know for sure that she was 100% Indo-European, but I'd be willing to bet money she was. And, of course, her limestone bust is painted like all our stuff was painted. Most of you don't know this, but most of the Sphinx and all this stuff in Rome, all these statues in ancient Greece, and they were all painted. Didn't matter if it was marble or limestone, they painted everything. We don't paint our statues, we keep them gray. But all our ancestors, way back when, apparently they painted everything. So when you're looking at a bust of Nefertiti, and you see that painted limestone, that's the rule. These gray statues that we see nowadays are the exception. They would have everything painted, and when the paint wore off, well, they'd repaint it. You know, just like you'd paint a house or something. But Nefertiti has an interesting story. Nefertiti ended up in Germany in the early 1900s, and she became the centerpiece for a dictator Germany had, Mein Führer. Or as I call Mein Führer. And Adolf Hitler had a fascination with her. And one of his generals maybe wanted to give her back to Egypt for Egypt helping them during the war, but Hitler refused to give it back, and this would have been in 1933 or something along those lines. And she's in a Berlin museum, and she has only been on tour a handful of times. I know she came to America once. And the Germans won't lend her to the Egyptians. The Egyptians want her back, and the Germans say, well, she's not a pop star. She doesn't go on tour. But something more fascinating about her. Hitler was building a huge museum in Berlin. And there's a big museum now there that they're putting a big extension on, but Hitler was building this massive museum. And the centerpiece of his museum was Nefertiti. Isn't that interesting? Who ends up not being King Tut's mother. And King Tut is the centerpiece of Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters New World Order Museum that no one knows about. One of the biggest things being built on this planet, one of the most beautiful, actually, but that no one's talking about. You know, it's very interesting stuff. There's some serious smoke here. The whole story, I don't know. But something's up with King Tut. Something's up with Akhenaten. Something's up with the Hyksos. Something's up with their New World Order. They are speeding up their timetable on everything across the board, even putting up their museum that they want to have during their rollout as they roll this stuff out. And it should be interesting to see what else comes out and what else shapes up. But I thought that was fascinating. The Germans found out everything about this, is my guess. Someone knows everything. And this goes all the way back to the man that won't die, Adolf Hitler. Nefertiti. Some speculate she was from some ancient dynasty that they tried to pull into by marriage to Akhenaten, the Hyksos. And who knows? Who knows the twists and turns this is going to take? But it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting stuff. So I just wanted to update you on that. We know that there's a big museum being built that most of the world has never heard of, with King Tut at the centerpiece. We know that Hitler had Nefertiti at the centerpiece of his new museum back in Berlin back in the day. We know that Nefertiti's still in Berlin and she ain't leaving. We know that Nefertiti is not King Tut's mother. We know that the DNA released on Akhenaten has a high probability of what was released of being Indo-European. We also know that King Tut comes from him and his sister. And King Tut was all messed up, really messed up kid, a lot of health problems. And we also know this has something to do with their New World Order, something to do with the Pink Rabbit Banksters and Leasters. The whole story, we don't know. Stay tuned. It'll come out. But I just wanted to update you on that. So look up the Grand Egyptian Museum. Looked up Zawi Hawass, watch him on TV, and let's see what he's looking for next, and we'll probably fill in the loops of some more Pink Rabbit Bankster and Leasters when they got going. Now, as far as the wild theories about Akhenaten, why he's so upside down, well, white rabbits aren't usually as upside down as this guy. This guy is completely backwards. Really odd. Really weird. You know, he's so weird. Again, he sticks out in Egyptian history so much that he ends up on Ancient Aliens as an alien, or part alien. And his kids are, health-wise, are real messed up, too. So I don't know. Inquiring minds want to know. But I thought I would update you on that, on all the facts. But someone accidentally released a percentage of... or some of his King Tut's paternal DNA, which means which would have been Akhenaten, and that's what started all the brouhaha. And what else can I add? The archaeologists and the scientists calling for all the information are actually mostly non-white. They want to know the facts, because it kind of goes against what Zawi Hawass said, that he said that they were just Egyptians. They weren't black and they weren't white. They weren't red. They weren't yellow. They were just Egyptians. And, of course, one of the archaeologists says, well, it looks like this Egyptian was part Indo-European at the minimum. So, you know, what's the deal with this guy? Where are they going with this one? Because in the history of Egypt, King Tut doesn't mean anything. But apparently he means something a whole lot to the Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters. And apparently their timetable's way out of whack, because they're not going for 2050 anymore. All of a sudden, in early 2002, as far as museum goes, they're lining up everything in front of 2012, so much so they're moving into the thing as I talk right now. So that's kind of an out-of-the-box thing that I've been watching this stuff around King Tut, and I mentioned this before, the Akhenatens, the Hyksos. And now, of course, he's going to be the centerpiece of museum. And Akhenaten's wife, Nefertiti, who is not his mother, was going to be the centerpiece of Hitler's museum. Inquiring minds want to know what's up with all this stuff. And I have a feeling the truth is going to be a little strange, but we'll stay tuned. In closing on this podcast, this particular edition of Horus the Avengers Follow White Rabbit, we leave with more questions than answers. But we're asking questions down a particular direction. That direction is toward war and how big it's going to be and who all is going to be involved. Is it going to, are they going to choose the quick route and go for the big decapitations? And take out China, or take out Iran, or both, or all of the above? Or are they going to be some slow, drawn out brawl? We're watching these coalitions build against the Chinese. And we're watching, coming into this fall, in the next few weeks, Israel negotiate with the Palestinians. All these events are taking place right in front of us. And, of course, we have this giant museum being built right next to the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, and no one in the world is even talking about it. But that's the job on this podcast, is to talk about things that no one else is talking about, or in a way you're not hearing anywhere else, to get you interested in being a consistent message. And that's the mantra. But we'll keep this discussion alive. But the questions keep mounting, and the trend is becoming pretty clear. You know, anytime you see someone go with a meme, and that's the meme would be in this case war with Iran. Then they let it drop. Then they come back to it, war with Iran. Then they pick up, it picks up speed, and then it dies down. Then they come back to it. They're going somewhere with it, and they've been at this a long time. The China stuff, well, we'll have to wait and see how that develops. It may develop, it should develop very quickly if they're going to do something. But we really don't know. The future is unknown. The trends are easy to observe. It's easy to observe a big coalition that's been built against China. It's easy to observe a bunch of different, missile interceptor platforms being tested all over the world. It's easy to observe these things or the big build up in the Gulf. But the true outcome is unknown. It's unknown whether they're going to play around with these guys and end up in some knockdown drag-out war, or whether they're going to go for the quick decapitation. Anything's possible. Anything's possible right now. And we're at a time on the calendar where the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, we will get big treats, because the universe loves us. Yes, it does. But we really don't know. And the Green Goddess, of course, is playing all her games. Yes, our Green Goddess Godzilla is very much alive. She's playing all her games, and we really don't know the fullest extent. The Russians and Germans aren't doing anything except selling everyone weapons and staying out of the war, by and large, on the periphery. And in reality, when it comes to World War III as it's shaping up, or what they bill as World War III, and all of its different variations, our race is stretched across from the whole top of the planet, and we got several other territories, and we don't have a home. But our exposure to World War III, compared to others, is pretty minimal. It's pretty minimal. It isn't minimal if you're in the military necessarily, but by and large, that's only a fraction. It's not minimal if you have a bunch of Muslims in your neighborhood and they may go nuts. But our race's exposure, the indigenous white rabbits of Europe and their exposure to World War III, is pretty minimal compared to most. With all these missile interceptors. And let's keep it that way. Let's keep it that way. Let's let the chaos surround us as we cruise on into the end game. Or as I say, as we coast into the end game, because that's what we're doing here now. We are coasting into this end game, and then we'll see. We'll see what's up with this young prince that is now the center spotlight of a giant museum that no one's talking about. The biggest thing to be built in the Giza Plateau since the pyramids. But no one's talking about it. And I'll put up several pieces on my Twitter, and you can cruise over there and see what we're reading. See what we're looking at. But there's no way to tell what Iran has until they go at it. There's no way to tell what Israel has or what the U.S. is going to unveil or what the Russians have done. Heaven forbid the Russians give Iran access to their GPS system. And those Katyusha rockets that start buzzing around Israel become dangerously accurate. Or who knows what the Chinese may have given them in guidance systems. What the Chinese have sold to them. What other type of drones have they sold to them? How accurate are these things going to be? We won't know anything until it's all done. We won't know whether this is going to be a knockdown, drag-out war, exactly how it's going to go, or whether it's going to be some big decapitation and they're going to roll to their new world order because they're pressed for time. That's one trend that has become clear in our enemies over the past 10 years. They are pressed for time for some reason. And we're interested in why. And we're interested in the whole deal behind these. Because we have a very unnatural situation here. Someone has tried to wipe out their founding gene pool. Yeah, the indigenous white rabbit of Europe, the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, as I call us, there's been an attempt at genocide, an attempt to wipe them out from their own elite. That is very unusual. Not unusual for Chairman Mao to wipe out those little yellow rabbits, but it is unusual for Chairman Mao to try to wipe out all the Chinese rabbits. That's very odd. It's very unnatural behavior. And when you have unnatural behavior, there has to be a rational reason for it. And so we're still waiting for answers, observing these trends, doing our particular job. And our particular job starts and ends with the mantra. And that's a consistent message from the bottom up. The only way it can happen. And you guys are doing a fantastic job with that. And I will continue to keep you entertained as we start coasting into the end game. And that's what we are doing. That's the pieces you see lining up, far and wide. The noise is getting bigger. The longer it goes, the bigger it's going to be, is what it looks like to me. The groups involved, whether it be the coalition against China or all this crazy stuff in the Middle East. You know, even the Turks have now just have made overtures to Iran, which is very odd. Very odd stuff going on. And we'll sit here and make our observations and do our job until the end. And this is another episode of Horus the Avenger's Follow the White Rabbit. And thank you for listening. We are now at the end of another episode of Horus the Avenger's Follow the White Rabbit. And this podcast is, of course, all as always, dedicated to practical politics. But I'd like to take this time to thank you for tuning in to another episode. On behalf of the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, it is yours truly, Horus the Avenger. And I'll be back with you in another episode in the near future. Until then, thank you for listening. No.